As of now, you are the authority. Hey, just like I told her, this doesn't concern you. Shut your mouth.
You all bought it. You all bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. You all bought it.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I found myself last night as I was wrapping up work here. I was watching Iron Sheik shoot interview clips on YouTube. Because who among us does not get sucked into the vortex of Iron Sheik shoot clips on YouTube? And in one of them, he is sitting down with Sean Oliver, drinking a Four Loko. Why would you give the Iron Sheik, of all people, a Four Loko to drink? I guess if you have DVDs to sell, you give the Iron Sheik a Four Loko. I couldn't believe that when I saw that. This whole weekend on wrestling Twitter was Four Loko. Holy shit. Let me just say this up front about the Corey Graves situation. I don't have a lot to say about it. I'm not spending much time beyond this next 60 seconds or so on this. I don't feel comfortable talking about this family stuff. I'm sure many of you know by now. His wife accused him. She went on Instagram and accused him of cheating on her with Carmella. Not Mandy Rose, as you would expect with Corey Graves, but with Carmella. And she posted text messages to alleged to have been sent by her husband that do not cast Corey Graves in a very positive light. He comes across in this like a complete scumbag. Carmella is no better, by the way, if this is all true. But we don't have all the facts, right? It's the one side of the story deal. It's like the Bray Wyatt and JoJo thing, where Bray's wife went public with accusations. We never did hear from Bray on that. We probably won't. I doubt that. But it made him out to look like a douchebag, too. Especially when there's kids involved, which there are in both situations. In Bray's situation, there's kids involved. And in this situation, Corey and his wife have three kids. You know, and that makes it so much worse, especially when you put this stuff out there publicly. I guess his wife felt that she had to, and she's certainly entitled to vent. But when you have kids involved, young kids, it sucks. But this might also explain why he's been acting like such a maniac on social media. You know, running his mouth, making all sorts of stupid comments. But we only have the wife's account. We have the wife's accusations to go on right now. And there's really nothing else to say about it. Look, I've never been married, but the only thing scarier than matrimony is alimony. So Corey's in a grave situation right now. He's going to have to sort through that. We have a President's Day sale starting tomorrow, Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. It runs right on through Wednesday. At 1 p.m. Eastern on ProWrestlingTees.com, you can get 20% off all Sound Off shirts in our store using the promo code PREZ, that's P-R-E-Z, at checkout. So go to ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff, and again, 20% off of all Sound Off shirts starting tomorrow, Monday through Wednesday at 1 o'clock Eastern. Audible, keep killing it on there. Keep sharing that link. I appreciate the hell out of you guys for it. AudibleTrial.com/Solomonster. Bunch of people so far this year have already gotten free books. It doesn't show me what books you guys cashed in on. I wish you would share that with me. I'm curious which books you guys are using your free book on. You get a 30-day trial. In that 30-day period, as you well know, you get one free audiobook, courtesy of this podcast. And even if you cancel the trial and you don't get billed and you want to move on, you get to take the book wherever you go. It's yours. So all you got to do is punch in audibletrial.com/Solomonster, sign up for the trial, and you can get your free wrestling book, non-wrestling book. There's a whole bunch of them up there. So take advantage of that. And thank you to all of our PayPal VIPs. You can make a PayPal donation anytime you'd like on thesolomonster.com. PayPal button's on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. I want to say thank you to Chuck Lunatic Lentz, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, We've got Out of Control, Cody Thomas, the Florida Freebird, Brian Passera, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, Jerome, You're Going Down, Eugenio, Fast Blast, Tim Banks. We've got Steven, Handyman Halistick, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T. This is quite the posse that we've put together here. I know these names in my sleep at this point. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Anarchist, Andrew Heller, Joe War Machine Wearing. Haven't heard from Joe in a while. Hope he's doing well. Tim Attack Before the Bell DeWolf, Interfere and I'll Kill You, Ingo Wabu, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Mixmaster Manny Juddy, and Recon Russell Bullware. And I want to send a shout out to Main Event, Marion Farrell. Jamie says hello. And White Velvet, Daryl McDonald, who I'm told just turned the big 3-0 on Friday. Hey, look, I've been there myself. It ain't so bad. Especially when everybody just kept thinking I was 25 anyway. Some people still do. Anyway, I hope you had a better day than Jimmy Uso and Corey Graves did this week. And here's to many more yet to come. Also, shout out to Darius Person, who left a very nice review for the show in iTunes, which I encourage you all to do if you have a quick moment of your time. I have been enjoying the Superstars drop on the WWE Network, all the episodes from 1992 that they put up a few weeks ago. I hope you are too, if you guys have been watching those episodes. I have been slacking, but I finally watched the episode where the Berserker nearly murdered or maimed the Undertaker with his giant sword. Had the Undertaker not rolled out of the way. And he stabbed a nice hole in the mat. An attempted murder here on Superstars from 92. That was actually a pretty crazy episode. So anyway, there's a lot of good stuff there. And I bring this up because per WWENetworkNews.com, they're about to add some more classic content, although not quite as classic as the early 90s stuff. I guess by today, though, this would be considered classic. In 2002, as I know some of you know, WWE created this tabloid news magazine-type show called Confidential, which was hosted by Mean Gene Okerlund, who recently passed away, and that might explain why they're uploading this now to the network. They had one famous segment that a lot of people, I'm sure, remember where they covered the death of Miss Elizabeth. And they covered it. They practically accused Lex Luger, who she was living with at the time, of murdering her, basically, in so many words. And look, Lex, I'm sure, did get her hooked on some things. He was probably a terrible influence on her for what he was probably doing at the time. And he may even admit to that now. And at the end of the day, we all make our own decisions, right? He's a big boy. She's a big girl. She was 40, what was she when she passed away? 43. I want to say she was 42 or 43 when she passed away. If I remember, I think it was, I know she was having some kind of back trouble. And maybe was drinking wine and mixing prescription medication, which is never a good recipe. But in any event, it was surreal at the time, to see them covering something like that on their own programming. They played the 911 call. This was like them trying to be TMZ before TMZ was a thing. Confidential is also the show where Shawn Michaels finally admitted for the very first time, publicly, what everybody already knew and figured, which is that he was in on the Montreal screwjob. He knew all along what was going to happen in Montreal. What a shock. So anyway, they're adding episodes of Confidential to the network in the Vault section starting tomorrow, starting this Monday, February 18th. I don't know that it's all of the episodes. It sounds like it's from the very first one all the way through early 2003. So I don't know that the Elizabeth episode I just mentioned is going to be part of this. I don't believe it is. But if you've never seen it before, for old time's sake, check it out. They did do some pretty good, like, personality profiles on there. It wasn't all just salacious kind of content. So, anyway, if you're into that old stuff, that's going up on the network tomorrow. WWE announced that Minute Maid Park in Houston, Texas, the home of the Houston Astros, will play host to the 2020 edition of the Royal Rumble, next year. This will be the second year in a row that the company runs a baseball stadium for the Rumble, which I am all in favor of. I thought Chase Field was a great place for a big pay-per-view, the way it looked on television visually. I thought it looked great. So I'm all for more dugout entrances. This one, like Chase Field, also has a retractable roof, which they can close if they like to. This place fits up to 41,000 people, so I think it's a little bit smaller than Chase Field. Chase Field had that pool in the outfield. I talked about this leading up to the pay-per-view. I was hoping they would use that pool. Yeah, I pitched the whole heavy machinery idea for some fun segments. Sadly, they did not make use of it. It may not have been their choice. That might have been a stadium decision. But the pool was closed, unfortunately, for the Royal Rumble. Well, Minute Maid Park, they don't have a pool, but they have kind of a gimmick of their own, which is the Minute Maid Park train. This thing stretches 56 feet long. It runs along a track above the left field wall. Whenever the Astros hit a home run, whenever the Astros win a game at home. So maybe they can run it at the end of each Rumble. You know, each Rumble match when the person wins, they can run that train. The Astrodome used to be the home of the Astros until 2000. And they moved to Minute Maid at that point, Minute Maid Park. Now, of course, WrestleMania 17, maybe the greatest WrestleMania of all time, top to bottom, took place inside the Astrodome. Now, the Astrodome is still standing. It's just not being used anymore. They wanted to renovate it. They wanted to turn it into a convention center, among other plans that local officials and the mayor have had for it over the years. But it's all been tied up in red tape. Nothing has happened in over a decade now since this place has been closed. Just sits there. It just sits there in limbo. It's a shame what happened when I think of the Pontiac Silverdome. You know, the home of WrestleMania 3, and I think of what happened to that building. Hopefully the same thing doesn't end up happening to the Astrodome, where it just gets abandoned and it sits there, which it already has, I guess, but where it just sits there for years and years and years. There's this great video. It gave me chills the first time I watched it. When you think of all the games played there, you think of WrestleMania 3 and Hogan slamming the Giant. It's for the Silverdome. You see in this video what the Silverdome looked like. Years after, decades even, after it was abandoned, it was this BMX biker, I don't remember his name, who got inside the stadium. He got inside the Silverdome, which of course did not have a roof, so it's this giant, basically it's this giant stadium. They call it the Silverdome, but at least as it was left, there was no there was no closed roof, so you can imagine what this place looked like after just sitting there for so long. And with the weather conditions up in Michigan and everything else, the place looked like a friggin' disaster zone. But I don't even know if this biker and his crew had permission. I would think they didn't. But they got inside the Silverdome and they set up this whole course, this whole BMX course with ramps and everything. And they, and again, the state of this place was sad. You have puddles of water and the, you know, in the concourse, moss was covering parts of it. Moss had grown. And the jumps this guy did. I mean, sad as it was to look at this place, this guy's doing jumps. He's going off the walls. It was incredible. You know, and the funny thing about the Silverdome is they tried to demolish it a couple of years ago, and their first attempt didn't work. So you saw Hogan slamming Andre didn't implode the place. Then they actually tried to implode it, and it didn't work. It kicked out at 2.5. Unfortunately for the Silverdome, the very next day they tried again, and this time they got most of it. At least the exterior collapsed. The interior was still standing even after they blew it up. So that's quite the stadium there. But anyway, Elimination Chamber is in Houston tonight, and so if you're going to the show, just be aware that they're going to be offering, at some point during the night, they're supposed to be offering people in attendance a pre-sale, I think it's a pre-sale code to buy Rumble tickets before they go on sale to the general public. So if you're going to the pay-per-view tonight, you'll have a leg up on all of us as far as getting tickets. Former WWE champion Pedro Morales passed away this week at the age of 76. WWE.com had his age listed as 78, but everywhere else I've seen, including ESPN, they have it listed as 76. He had been battling Parkinson's disease for many years. Puerto Rican native, he was inducted by Savio Vega into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 1995. That was the year, I think, before they abandoned the Hall of Fame until they finally brought it back in 04. And Savio also accepted on his behalf. I believe that Morales is the only, you know, at the time was the only living Hall of Fame inductee not to have been present for his own induction. So they had somebody who was among the living, because God knows they've inducted a lot of people who have passed. But he was alive at the time, and they inducted him, and he didn't show up for his induction. I believe he may have been doing announcing at the time, Spanish language announcing for WCW. So there may have been a conflict there. I don't think it's that he had heat with them or intentionally stiffed them, I don't think. It may have just been some kind of scheduling conflict. Or just the fact that he was working for WCW and couldn't show up at a WWE event. But you rarely, if ever, heard this guy's name mentioned in the last probably two decades, really, on WWE television. For all of the nostalgia and all of the, you know, maybe they show clips of him in like history videos and stuff, but never focused on him or really mentioned him by name, gave him any sort of attention. Not even an interview on .com. You know, forget television. You know, they've had these "Where Are They Now?" kind of interviews with people. Unless I missed it, I don't remember there being a Pedro Morales interview. Just nothing. And I always thought that was very strange. As popular as he was as champion, as long as he was champion for, over 1,000 days, that he was simply never mentioned. He is the first man in WWE history to win the Triple Crown. That being the WWE Championship, the Intercontinental Championship, and he was the first ever two-time Intercontinental Champion. And he also won the tag team title with Bob Backlund. They won the titles at that same Shea Stadium show where Hulk Hogan wrestled Andre the Giant long before their battle at WrestleMania 3. And I think Hogan even slammed him in the match like it was no big deal, which is kind of funny when you look years later at what a big deal it was for Hogan to slam Andre. There are still people who think that was the first time that Hogan ever slammed Andre. A young me probably thought the same thing until I started seeing clips of old matches and I said, wait a minute. I feel hoodwinked here. But their run as tag team champions, Morales and Backlund, lasted all of a day. Backlund was already WWF champion at the time. They were forced to vacate the tag team titles. None of this two-champion bullshit. Actually, when you think about it, you know, when you really read up on Morales and if you watched him, you know, back in his heyday, realistically, he wasn't a Triple Crown winner. He was a Grand Slam winner. He was the first ever Grand Slam winner in WWE because he also held the old WWWF United States Championship. They used to have a United States title. The company retired it in the mid-70s. So that's even more impressive when you think about it. Four titles, not three. As far as how he became champion, it's kind of interesting. You know, Bruno Sammartino was champion for so long. Years and years. 8 years this guy was champion for. He was burned out. He was tired of it. He was hurt. He wanted to go home. He wanted to be with his family. He was done. And so the decision was made, and they begged him to stay. Because Bruno was such a huge draw. In the Northeast, Madison Square Garden, that string of sellouts that he had, Vince Sr. did not want him to leave. Bruno said, I'm done. You got to find somebody else. And so the decision was made they were going to get the championship onto Pedro Morales. Now, I saw a note in the Observer that he was not their first choice. They wanted to go with a different Italian name because Bruno had such a big following among the Italian fan base, you know, in New York. So they had chosen, originally they had chosen a man by the name of Mario Milano to be the successor to Bruno Sammartino as the WWF champion. And he was very big in Australia. He'd been working in Australia at the time, was a big name down there. And they pitched him and ultimately he decided that he wanted to stay down in Australia. And at that point, I think it was Gorilla Monsoon was the one who pushed for Morales. And so they went with Pedro. Vote for Pedro, said Gorilla Monsoon. So before they could get the title on Morales, Bruno had to drop it to a heel because they were not going to have Bruno drop it to another babyface. So he did so. He dropped the championship, one of the most famous matches in, I was going to say WWE history. Realistically, it's one of the most famous matches in wrestling history. He dropped the title at MSG to Ivan Koloff. And when the referee counted three in that match, there was this stunned silence in the crowd. People could not believe that Bruno had lost the championship. 8 years this guy was champion for. I don't even think they presented Koloff with the title until he got backstage to the dressing room. I guess they were worried about what the fans might do. And it was only a few weeks later in that very same building that Morales pinned Koloff to become the new champion. And he defended against a ton of names, Fred Blassie and George Steele, Blackjack Mulligan, Ernie Ladd, Larry the Axe, who passed away recently. And there's another famous match where he wrestled Bruno. It was this rare, you know, face-versus-face match. And maybe back then it wasn't so rare, because it was after this, they really didn't do them much. Maybe for a period of time, they did do babyface against babyface. But they did Pedro and Bruno had a match in the showdown at Shea Stadium, the old home of the New York Mets. A lot of misery in that stadium, let me tell you. Oh, a lot of good days, too. It wasn't always so miserable. But yes, there was a lot of misery in that stadium. But they went over an hour. They went to a curfew draw at Shea Stadium, this show the company did in 1972. Yes, the State Athletic Commission imposed a curfew. It's like they played the role of angry parent and they called the match because they had passed their curfew, like a teenager. So that was a pretty famous match. Morales sold out Madison Square Garden 21 times in 30 title matches during his run as champion. He held the championship for 1,027 days before dropping it to Stan Stasiak. And Stan Stasiak, although he was champion, he is but a footnote in history because he only held the title for 9 days before dropping it back to Bruno. It's like the Hogan thing, right? Hogan was champion for all those years. 4 years as the champion. And Vince McMahon is ready to anoint a new successor. He wants to push the Ultimate Warrior to be the guy to replace Hulk Hogan. Hogan even does the job for him at WrestleMania. Now it's Warrior's time, and what happened? Warrior flamed out. He flamed out. What'd Vince do? He went back to his tried and true. Got the belt back on Hogan the following year. Like father, like son. So I'm sure they couldn't wait to get Bruno back. They obviously gave him a very nice deal, and they convinced him to come back, and Bruno did. And so they put the championship back on him. You can't find footage, by the way, if you look, as I've tried. You cannot find footage of the title change when Pedro lost the title. You can't find it anywhere because supposedly it doesn't exist. If it does, I hope WWE uploads it one day as a hidden gem on the network. But no one, to my knowledge, has ever actually seen footage of it, so they may not have filmed it. But Pedro was so like insanely over with the Latin audience back then. And they were so terrified of a possible riot when he lost the championship to Stasiak. The ring announcer, when he made the announcement at the end of the match after Stasiak had won, said, "Let's hear it for Pedro Morales." That was the big announcement at the end of the match. And then they waited a day to announce the title change in the local newspapers. That's how afraid they were. When kayfabe was still very much alive. Blackjack Mulligan. Well, Blackjack Mulligan almost wasn't alive anymore. He wrestled Pedro. There was a match in the Boston Garden that they had. This was when Pedro was the champion. And the Boston Globe, actually, I was reading up on this old story. And they did this story in like 05. I think they were just revisiting old incidents, sports incidents, or whatever the subject was. But you can look up the article in the Boston Globe talked about this. There was an incident where Mulligan was on his way to the ring, and he was about to climb into the ring for a match against Pedro Morales. And this crazed fan, I guess, jumps the barricade and stabs Mulligan in the thigh with a butcher knife. And Bobby Heenan, in his book, he said that they took Mulligan to the hospital they realized at that point that the fan, I guess he'd gone one step further. He wanted to do maximum damage here. And before he stabbed Mulligan, he had dipped the knife in pig fat. And so Mulligan's leg became infected. And that's never a good thing. That could have gone so much worse. It took him a while to recover. He did recover. He didn't lose the leg or anything. But think about that. Think about how sick in the brain you've got to be to stab a person, just anybody with a butcher knife, but to dip it in pig fat before you actually stab them. And it took 100 stitches to sew him up. So he had a lot of fans. There's long been a story, which has never been corroborated, and it probably never will be. But it's been out there for years, and wrestlers have talked about it. And I know Jim Cornette has talked about it before. That Morales supposedly pawned his world title belt while he was the champion to pay off gambling debts. He at the time had claimed that the title was stolen out of his car. That's just like Bruno Sammartino. There were stories in the newspaper when it happened that Bruno was out to dinner. He was in the city. He was eating. And when he got back to his car, he realized that, I guess, his car had been broken into and his championship had been stolen. Well, Pedro claimed the same thing. He claimed that his title was stolen out of his car. Later on, his belt turned up in a pawn shop, I think in Philly, and some wrestling collector ended up buying it. But when Cornette told the story on his podcast, this is going back, I think, a couple of years now, Pedro allegedly paid $125 to pawn his title belt. And there was another wrestler named Pete Sanchez. When he was asked about why Pedro would pawn the belt, why would he do such a thing? Sanchez made the comment that Pedro loved the horses. So he may have had some gambling issues, and it's just an interesting little story to think that the champion, you know, your world champion at the time for one, you know, this big organization, would pawn his title belt because he had to pay off gambling debts. He was still wrestling with WWE through 87. He even got an Intercontinental title match at one point against the Honky Tonk Man. I think highlights of it aired on Primetime Wrestling. He did some announcing for WWE, did some announcing for WCW. After that, he retreated back into civilian life. He made some convention appearances over the years. He wasn't a total hermit or anything like that. In fact, the last photo I've seen of Pedro Morales was from a convention. It was a photo of him, Bruno Sammartino, and there was somebody else in the photo. I can't remember who. Like three big wrestling names from that era, all in one photo. And supposedly it was taken in 2012 or 2013, so he was still making sporadic appearances until his health just began to deteriorate. He didn't go out as much. But a forgotten champion in some respects. That's why I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the guy, because WWE sure didn't. I mean, they put a graphic up for him this week at the beginning of some of the shows. I think they put a video together, a short video. I don't remember if it aired on any of the shows this week. I know it's on their YouTube channel. But, you know, they did the bare minimum that you would expect. But boy, I mean, you talk about a guy with a place in history like he had, and the lack of attention and respect paid to him over the years. It's almost bewildering. And I think what hurt him probably in some respects, I don't think being sandwiched between two Bruno Sammartino title runs did him any favors. I mean, think of the shoes this guy had to fill, and he had his fans, don't get me wrong. He did very good for himself. But that would be like Michael Cole coming after Jim Ross and trying to, you know, become the new play-by-play guy and replacing probably the best play-by-play announcer in history. It's almost unfair. And he had to come after Bruno and fill those shoes, and that was, you know, I'm sure not an easy thing to do. And so people talk about Bruno and, you know, maybe some of these other people don't get as much attention paid to them because they're just sort of lost in the mix there. And that might have hurt him a little bit too, but I wanted to make sure that we covered him appropriately here on the show, and now everybody can go off and check out some of his work, because I'm sure you can find a bunch of Pedro matches on YouTube. You can find pretty much everything on YouTube, except you will not find the night that he lost the championship. I challenge anybody to find that footage, because I don't think it exists. This was not a good week if you are a WWE performer, as far as having TMZ post stories about you this week. Not a good week. Corey Graves was not the only one being talked about online. Jimmy Uso, TMZ broke the story, was arrested this week after a drunken confrontation with cops in Detroit. He is taking this Uso penitentiary thing way too seriously, and there have been so many Uso penitentiary jokes online this week that I didn't even bother trying to make one online, because what's the point? He and his wife, Naomi, they were pulled over in downtown Detroit after the cops allege Naomi was driving the wrong way down a one-way street. Cops say their SUV reeked of alcohol, so they ordered Naomi to get out of the car. Now, while she's outside the car talking to the cops, Jimmy decides, in his infinite wisdom, although we don't know what was being said, true enough, but he gets out of the car. Apparently, he wasn't asked. He gets out of the car. Not the smartest thing to do. And he gets out of the car. He takes his shirt off. He's squaring up like he wants a fight. Not a good idea. This could have gone so wrong that we could seriously be covering a death here in this story for any number of reasons. So we can kind of joke about it and all that, but the reality is this could have been a lot worse. So he's taking his shirt off. He wants a fight. One of the cops takes out a taser. I guess they feared for their life. Jimmy then, he settled down. He was arrested for disorderly conduct, obstruction. They took him to jail. He posted bond and he was released. What a wild episode of Ride Along this is going to be. I cannot wait until this hits the network. We only have one version of events, but this is far from the first time that the Usos have had a run-in with the law related to alcohol. This is not a one-time isolated incident here. I mean, hell, it's not even Jimmy's first time. He was arrested back in 2011 on suspicion of DUI, ironically, for driving the wrong way down a one-way street. I guess they really are soulmates, these two. Just last year, Jey Uso was on TMZ. His mugshot was plastered all over the place. He was arrested, allegedly, for driving while intoxicated. I think this was down in Texas. Their own father once ran down another human being in cold blood on pay-per-view. For all we know, he was drunk too. It must run in the family. I knew I would regret recording these pay-per-view predictions that I did 4 days in advance. As soon as I sat down on Wednesday, I think it was, I said to myself, I know I'm setting myself up for something. Some big story's going to break. Somebody's going to get hurt. Something's going to happen here. But there's no turning back now. Look, and I'm going to get to the predictions here in a second. I'll play them for the people who didn't hear it. But I still say the Usos walk out tonight as the new tag team champions. I don't think this changes the outcome at all. And I say that if for no other reason, because we know that their contracts are said to be expiring in April, right? We just talked about this last week. The Usos have been negotiating. They've been talking to WWE. WWE does not want to lose them. They are arguably the best tag team in the company. Certainly one of, if not the best tag team in the company. I don't think that they are going to do anything to these guys right now. I don't think this changes the fact that they want to keep the Usos. So to punish them, and this is the tough thing, and I always say this whenever we hear about it, like one half of a tag team getting into trouble, or one half of a tag team is hurt, and they're on the shelf, and they're going to be gone for 6 months or 9 months, it's got to suck for the other person on that team. And look, Jey has had his issues before, as I just said, but still, Jimmy got himself in trouble here, whatever happened. It wasn't Jey. Jey, as far as we know, wasn't in the car. I don't know where he was. Maybe he was home with his family. But it's always a risk that you run when you're in a tag team. Because your whole career, your push, if you're a champion, your title run, whatever it may be, and the money you make, all of that can just go up in smoke through no fault of your own if something happened to your tag team partner. And so I'd kind of feel bad for Jey, honestly, if these guys did get punished, because it wouldn't just be Jimmy getting punished, it would be Jey also. And as far as anybody knows, he had nothing to do with this. But I still don't think that this changes any outcomes for the pay-per-view, and I had already predicted the Usos to win the titles. I'm going to stick to that. I did see this one comment, and I saw that it was attributed, I think, to a Fox News article, so yeah, whatever, but Mentioned that Uso and his wife want to get fired by the WWE, and so this arrest might just be the shoot. I don't know if they were arguing that this was something that they did intentionally. I don't think that's what they were arguing here. I think the argument is this happened, but it happened at a time when they are trying to get fired, and so this might just get them what they want. I don't know that I buy that they're trying to get fired. I don't know why Naomi would be trying to get fired, but who knows? I don't buy that. I don't buy into that. But we'll see, again, if there's any repercussions to this. There have been incidents like this before, and I don't recall there being any great punishment for these guys. And now that their contracts are coming up and the company's trying to keep them, I can't imagine that it's going to be any different this time. Now, I mentioned the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view is tonight, and I did a early predictions video. I try now every month, if I can, to get the predictions up early on YouTube. Because sometimes when the main show goes up, not everybody can listen to it right away. And now the pay-per-view is either just about to start or it's already over and there's predictions. And so I try to get them up early. But not everybody listens to them on YouTube. I get that. And so if you have not and you want to hear the chamber rundown, my thoughts on some of the things that happened this week with respect to the pay-per-view, predictions, all that, I'm going to play the audio now that I recorded a few days ago. Again, this predates Jimmy Uso's situation and all that stuff. If you would like to skip it because you already heard it, then you can skip ahead about 40 minutes. So I'm going to timestamp it for you. You can skip ahead 40 minutes and move on to the rest of the news. But if you have not heard it, here are my Elimination Chamber predictions for the pay-per-view tonight. WWE Elimination Chamber is coming up this Sunday. It is the second-to-last event on the road to WrestleMania. We still have Fastlane coming up next month. The Chamber pay-per-view has produced some pretty good matches over the years. I was just watching some highlights earlier of the one from 2 years ago where Bray Wyatt, in case people forgot, yes, Bray Wyatt, believe it or not, was WWE champion once before. And the match where he won the championship, the Chamber match, actually one of the more exciting ones. One of my favorite Chamber matches they've ever done. So I'm hoping we get a couple of good ones this weekend. I will have a full review of the show up on the YouTube channel late Sunday night, early Monday morning, as I normally do after all of the pay-per-views. So for those of you wondering, you can catch the review on YouTube as always. So let's get right into it here. We'll run through a preview of the show, give some predictions, just so you guys know I'm recording this on Wednesday night. So we're still about 4 days or so out from the pay-per-view. I fully expect that they'll probably add at least one more match, probably a kickoff match, probably a tag team title match for the Raw brand, if I had a guess. So it is Wednesday night as I am recording this, just FYI. We have Buddy Murphy defending the Cruiserweight Championship against Akira Tozawa. And if I had to take a guess, this will be the kickoff match or one of the kickoff matches. That's usually the way they treat the Cruiserweight title, unfortunately. Tozawa became the number one contender. He beat Cedric Alexander, Leo Rush, and Humberto Carrillo in a fatal four-way elimination match 2 weeks ago. This week on 205 Live, I actually did catch some of 205 Live this week. And there was a hell of a no DQ match on this show involving Noam Dar that I would actually tell all of you it's worth going out of your way to see. But on 205 Live this week, they had a contract signing. Backstage, it was officiated by Drake Maverick, the GM. And I like this format. You know, I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, man, I like this format so much better than the tired, let's get in the ring and we'll do it in front of the crowd. And, you know, when they sort of venture outside the ring and they do things in the back or in other locations, change things up a little bit. I tend to like it a little bit more. You know, they did that one contract signing backstage last year on SmackDown before one of the pay-per-views where AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura were wrestling for the championship. This would have been sometime after WrestleMania. And they did it in the back. And I don't even know that you necessarily heard the crowd, but the way they shot that I thought was brilliant. So just, you know, I just happened to think that this was a pretty good segment they had on Tuesday night. But it's all a moot point anyway, because I don't think Tozawa is winning the title, so I think Buddy Murphy retains. I see no reason to take the championship off of him. And for all the success, the short-lived success so far that Mustafa Ali, and I'm going to talk about him in a little bit, But for all the success he's had in a short period of time on the main roster, Buddy Murphy is another one who before long, I would say in a matter of months, should end up on Raw or SmackDown. You know, he is good enough to hang with the big boys on the big shows. And who knows, you know, we have this international shakeup coming up in April. Maybe he'll be shaken off of 205 Live and onto one of the main brands. But I think he retains here. We have Braun Strowman taking on Baron Corbin, now in a no disqualification match. It pains my soul that this feud is still going on. They have already cooled off Strowman enough. The last thing this guy needs is a loss to Baron Corbin. I think Strowman wins. But where Corbin goes, so too does Drew McIntyre. And if we see Drew, that probably means we see Kurt Angle. Now that it's no DQ, I think it's a given that we're going to have some kind of interference here. But if Strowman's going to do the job for either one of these guys, and maybe he won't, but if he is, it should be McIntyre at WrestleMania. It should not be Baron Corbin at the Elimination Chamber. So I'm picking Strowman to win. We have an Elimination Chamber match to crown all new women's tag team champions, not first time women's tag team champions. I saw that phrasing on WWE.com. Show some respect to the Jumping Bomb Angels. You know, the Jumping Bomb Angels in their day would have embarrassed half of the teams in this match. I mean, hell, they might embarrass them today. We have Sasha Banks and Bayley, the Iconics, Nia Jax and Tamina, the Riot Squad, Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville, and Carmella and Naomi. They are your teams in this match. Sasha and Bayley will start the match, as well as Mandy and Sonya. By virtue of their losses on TV this week, they will open the match. The WrestleVotes account on Twitter claims to have a source that told them that the brand split is effectively going to be coming to an end for the women in WWE. Not necessarily with the men, but for the women, for all intents and purposes, it is likely coming to an end. Now, we've already seen Charlotte, we've seen Becky Lynch go back and forth between Raw and SmackDown ever since the Royal Rumble. I think it's the right move, if it's true. If the story is true, I think it's the right move. There simply are not enough women right now on either roster, especially SmackDown. And this has been a big problem for the SmackDown brand for a long time. That the depth they have on that women's roster just isn't there. And to really keep things interesting, I think this is a necessary move. Now, you could say the same thing about the men's tag team division on both shows, especially Raw, but you could say the same thing about the men's tag team divisions. I'm all in favor of crossing over. I was not in favor of bringing the brand split back to begin with. You guys know that. It has its benefits. You know, you want to weigh the pros and cons, having a brand split, not having a brand split. There are arguments to be made on both sides. I'm not saying it has no benefit whatsoever. I'm not saying it can't be exciting if you know what you're doing. I've just never been a fan of it. I've never been a fan of the way WWE does it. They've never fully, truly honored it and made it a real brand split. I'm just not a fan of it. Now, they're having a draft in April. They've already announced. So it's not fully going away. But for the women, again, I think it's a good move. And if this is true, maybe there is something to the idea of some kind of a women's championship unification. Yeah, there's been rumors of that maybe for WrestleMania. I haven't heard a lot of that lately, but there have been people for the longest time now, last few months, speculating, hey, maybe it's going to be Becky and Ronda, champion versus champion, or Charlotte and Ronda, and the Raw women's title, and the SmackDown women's title would be on the line. And, you know, lately it certainly doesn't look like that's the case, but maybe there's something to that. If they move forward with these plans, you know, maybe they would have Asuka drop the title to Charlotte on television sometime before Mania just to get that title into the main event. Maybe, and I think if anything, this would be more likely, maybe they would set up a WrestleMania 30 type of scenario. And I don't think that's ideal just because WrestleMania 30 wasn't even that long ago. If you're going to borrow some of your own ideas, I would want to space things out a little bit more, but maybe they go with the WrestleMania 30 scenario and they force Becky, in light of what happened on TV this week with the suspension and everything, and they want to have her really fight for it. That's sort of what they're going for with that storyline. Maybe the McMahons force Becky to have to go through Asuka at the start of WrestleMania in the opening match to earn herself a spot in the main event with Charlotte and Ronda Rousey. They forced her to do it Daniel Bryan style. And if the championship is on the line, the SmackDown women's title, maybe she wins it from Asuka in the opening match. Then the Raw title is on the line. The SmackDown title is on the line. I have no doubt that the final scene of WrestleMania will be Becky Lynch celebrating a win. Maybe it ends up being with both the Raw and the SmackDown women's titles. It would at least make sense. It would at least make sense then that they had Becky, who is their hottest performer on television right now, Raw or SmackDown. Whether you like what they're doing with her, whether you're a Becky Lynch fan or not, she certainly has been positioned in the reactions that she's been getting. She is the hottest star on either brand right now. And when you compare it to past eras and stuff, we can get into that whole thing. Where she ranks on that scale probably isn't very high. But certainly for this period now, she's very popular. And they had her not just lose to Asuka at the Royal Rumble, they had her tap out. There was no interference. There was no debate. There was no, she passed out. She tapped out to a woman who has not been seen since the Royal Rumble. For all we know, Asuka was kidnapped in the parking lot outside of Chase Field. Nobody's seen her. But yet they had Becky Lynch tap out to Asuka. You would certainly think they have something up their sleeve for Asuka. You would hope. Well, maybe that's the plan. Maybe they did it so that when the McMahons tell Becky that, hey, you've got to beat Asuka to get into the main event, they can point to the fact that she already tapped out once. Just to plant that doubt in people's minds, can she do it? But the fact is, if the women are going to be appearing on both shows, if that is the plan going forward, there is no need to have two separate singles women's championships. Especially when you have a SmackDown women's champion who hasn't been seen in 3 weeks. One singles title, one set of tag team belts that float between the shows is all that you need. As far as the chamber match is concerned, I think it's a lock that Sasha and Bayley are going to win the titles here. I mean, I look at the lineup here, and if I had to pick a dark horse, you could say that maybe they make Sasha and Bayley go to WrestleMania. They have to beat Nia and Tamina, but I think it happens here. I think it's a lock. Sasha and Bayley, they're going to open the match. They're fighting from behind. You've got plus the story of Sasha and her injuries, which I'm sure they'll play up on commentary in this match. She's been cleared, but she's been suffering from injuries, supposedly a shoulder injury. These titles were made for these two women, and I think it's going to make for a great moment when they finally win them. After an entire year of nothing, it was a lost year for Sasha and Bayley. This is their moment. This is their crowning moment here. And the other reason why I say that they win here instead of WrestleMania, and this is just my opinion, and a lot of people are not going to like hearing this, but I believe, as far as, well, who do they defend against at WrestleMania? Let's say they win. Who do they defend against on the biggest show of the year? I posted a tweet yesterday. Total Bellas is sinking like a stone in the ratings. Each episode this season so far, there's been 4 or 5 episodes. Each episode has done less viewers than the one before it. Which means, don't be surprised to see Nikki and Brie back on television very soon. And if they are, I think it's going to be Sasha and Bayley defending those tag team titles at WrestleMania against the Bella Twins. We have Finn Balor challenging Bobby Lashley and Leo Rush. It's a handicap match for the Intercontinental Championship. I think it's too early to put the title on Balor. I think you wait until WrestleMania. You do it one-on-one. None of this handicap nonsense. You go one-on-one, Balor and Lashley, and Balor wins the championship. It just doesn't happen on this show. So I'm picking Bobby Lashley and Leo Rush. We have the Usos challenging Shane McMahon and The Miz for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. They did a McMiz TV segment. Is that what they were calling it, I think, right? McMiz? Sounds like something that is only available for a few weeks at McDonald's that you can buy for $1. So we had McMiz TV on Tuesday night with the Usos. And the Usos were excellent. I mean, they always are in these types of segments. Promo-wise, the Usos are great. But one of the takeaways from that segment was that the Usos, in talking about themselves and you know, being a tag team, one of the takeaways was that the Usos sometimes bathe together. Not just as kids. They bathe together to this very day because they're twins. I didn't know that was a rule. Miz appeared to be disgusted by this revelation. And I'm watching this, and it just reminded me of this great, just one of the great Coke-filled promos of the Macho Man's career way back when, long before his WWE days, in the early 80s, back when he was still working for his father's ICW promotion. That was the Poffo family promotion. He was teaming at the time. His tag team partner was Cowboy Bob Orton. Cowboy Bob and the Macho Man were a tag team. And I'll never forget watching this thing. It's like a minute long, just like some kind of backstage or in-studio stand-up promo that they did. Savage looked like Hillbilly Jim in this segment. He had the fisherman's hat, big scruffy beard. And they were just talking about a match that was coming up. I think it was against Pat Patterson or Ray Stevens. And Savage is talking about how he and the Cowboy, you know, they do everything together. You know, we ride together. We train together. We even... And then he just sort of laughs. Like, I'm like, I don't even need to know what that means. I don't want to know what the means. Don't even want to know. But this Shane-Miz alliance is not going to last much longer. It can't. It can't. It's only a matter of time before there is a miscommunication of some kind. I'm not saying it's been this long-standing plan when someone's going to turn on each other. It's probably some kind of miscommunication. Things start to go downhill. And it all just falls apart. The only question is, does it happen on this show, or do they keep the belts on them until Fastlane? I say the beginning of the end starts here. I predict the Usos will win back the tag team titles. Another thing to consider here is that their deals, their contracts, are said to be expiring in April. They have not yet signed new deals. They are negotiating with WWE as we speak, kind of like AJ Styles is. And we know the Revival asked for their release not too long ago, and now they're the Raw Tag Team Champions. I think the Usos get the belts back here. We have Ronda Rousey defending her Raw Women's Championship against Ruby Riott. There is absolutely zero chance that Ronda Rousey loses her title to Ruby Riott, or that Ruby Riott becomes the first person to beat Ronda Rousey in a one-on-one singles match. Zero. Goose egg. Now, I admit, many, many years ago on the Sound Off, I answered a mailbag question. Somebody asked me, what are the chances that we will see a match someday between John Cena and The Rock? Because John Cena had been calling The Rock out in the media. This is when The Rock was in that period where he wasn't working with WWE. Many years had gone by, he hadn't wrestled. And I believe my exact answer was, there is less than 0% chance of that happening. One of my all-time great flubs. So, hey, maybe I'm wrong. But I don't think that there is a snowball's chance in hell is what Ruby Riott has of winning this match. Now, Ruby, I have to say this about her. Ruby has impressed, I think, since coming up to the main roster. She's put in some really good matches. When she was in NXT, she was a babyface. She wasn't part of a faction. There really wasn't a whole lot to her. She had a unique look, but she did nothing for me. I mean, she could wrestle, but there was nothing terribly exciting about her matches. She was one of the big surprises to me when she was called up and they made her a heel and she had her own faction. And she started to wrestle people like Sasha Banks and some of the other stars on the brand. And she was cranking out really good matches. So Ruby is really good. And I'm not saying, I think one day she'll make a fine women's champion. But that's not happening anytime soon. Ronda Rousey retains. We know Charlotte. She said on SmackDown she's going to be front row. She has stolen Becky Lynch's spot for now. At WrestleMania, she has promised to be front row and center for Ronda's match at the pay-per-view. So we'll see what happens there. But yes, Ronda will retain her championship. And finally, we have an Elimination Chamber match for the WWE Championship. The new Daniel Bryan. Look, can I just say something here? I made a comment a few weeks ago about these ridiculous nicknames and monikers that they give some of these people. When Daniel Bryan got eliminated from the Gauntlet match on SmackDown, which was awesome, and I'll get to that in a second. When he was eliminated, they actually had, was it Greg Hamilton? See the ring announcer? They had him announce that, not just that Daniel Bryan was eliminated, he had to say, the new Daniel Bryan has been eliminated. Who talks like that? Who talks like that? The new Daniel Bryan has been eliminated. Well, thank you. Thank you for clarifying. I thought the old Daniel Bryan had been eliminated. Just sounded so stupid. Well, anyway, the new Daniel Bryan defends the WWE Championship, his wood belt, don't tell Kevin Dunn, against AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Randy Orton, Jeff Hardy, and Kofi Kingston, replacing the injured Mustafa Ali. Mustafa Ali is all banged up right now. He reportedly suffered a concussion, and of course he got that nasty black eye last week after having his face stomped on by Randy Orton. The same Randy Orton who, by virtue of swooping in and winning the Gauntlet match on SmackDown in the final 10 seconds, will now have the luxury of entering the chamber last. So he will be the last one out of the pod on Sunday. So to go back to SmackDown here, Mustafa Ali is out, and Kofi Kingston is put in his place. And they were having a Gauntlet match, as I mentioned, to determine who would enter in the last position in the chamber match on Sunday. Well, Kofi Kingston opened the Gauntlet against the champion, Daniel Bryan. And they went probably, I think it was close to 25 minutes that these two wrestled. And it was very good, and he pinned the WWE champion. Kofi Kingston pinned Daniel Bryan and eliminated him. First one out of the Gauntlet was Daniel Bryan. From there, Kofi went on to beat Jeff Hardy. He went on to beat Samoa Joe. He pinned Joe with the Bret Hart, Roddy Piper kick off the turnbuckle finish from WrestleMania 8. Joe killed him afterwards, of course. Can't let that go unavenged. AJ Styles was in next. It was at this point when Tom Phillips, 50 minutes or so into this match, wasn't over yet, makes the comment. He says that this might be the longest that anybody has wrestled a match in SmackDown history. Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar would like to have a word with you, Tom. What is with these commentators? You had Corey Graves of the Royal Rumble talking about how Ric Flair once in 1992 entered the Royal Rumble at number one to win the championship, which is not true. Now we have Tom Phillips talking about how 50 minutes into this match and Kofi Kingston, hey, he may have the record here. Longest match, longest performance in SmackDown history. Let's forget the hour-long Iron Man match that we had all those many years ago with two men, no less, who are still in the company and actively wrestling. Anyway, that's the I know that's the nerd in me going back many. I still think that it should mean something. I think that your announcers should know that sort of thing. I don't think that's asking too much. AJ Styles and Kofi Kingston, they did have a match. It was great while it lasted. Kofi tapped out to the calf crusher. That was just past the 1 hour mark. So 60 minutes. Kofi Kingston lasted 60 minutes here in this gauntlet. For all the praise that Seth Rollins got last year for going the distance in that Raw gauntlet, I think Kofi deserves the same praise here. It was a hell of a performance. Maybe the best night of his career. And with AJ waiting for Randy Orton to come out, Orton was going to be the last one into the gauntlet. Orton hit him with an RKO from behind, out of nowhere, and pinned AJ to win. So, not a bad day at the office for young Randall. Arrive, RKO, and leave. And with that, he gets to enter the chamber last on Sunday. Orton retweeted a fan after the show, this like a Randy Orton super fan. I don't know if they're as bad as the Alexa Bliss or Bella Twins or, God forbid, even TNA diehards, but a Randy Orton super fan tweeted him and claimed that with his win here on the show, Orton is now third all-time for most TV matches in WWE history with 746 matches under his belt. Up next, in the number two spot, is The Big Show with 798 matches. This person did not mention who is currently in first place. My guess, it's got to be Kane. It's got to be Kane, right? It's got to be. Kane holds all the records. Doesn't Kane hold the record for just most matches, period? I could have sworn like a year or two ago there was some kind of TV record that this guy set. He used to hold the record for eliminations in the Royal Rumble until Roman Reigns came along and he screwed the whole thing up. So you look at the end of this gauntlet on TV and you wonder, you know, does Orton pinning Styles the way that he did, is that the first seed planted for a WrestleMania match? Because, you know, look, I love AJ, but at the same time, I'm kind of over the whole AJ versus Daniel Bryan WWE title match deal. Unless AJ wins the championship, you know, on this show, which I don't think he is, he doesn't have any obvious match or obvious opponent for WrestleMania. He and Randy Orton have never had a proper program. They've had one or two matches on TV over the last couple of years. They've never had any kind of a pay-per-view program, pay-per-view match. So you could be looking at Randy Orton against AJ Styles just one-on-one at WrestleMania this year. That could have been the first shot fired. Now, I have to assume, I don't know this, but I have to assume, because Mustafa Ali, to my knowledge, I believe he was at TV. He was being evaluated. I'm sure he's just gutted they wouldn't medically clear him. And there was still some hope up until Tuesday that they might clear him and he might be able to wrestle, and then ultimately he was not. I have to assume plans were already set, and the Iron Man spot in that gauntlet that went to Kofi Kingston was originally intended for Mustafa Ali. And which makes me really sad for Ali, because here he is getting the biggest push of his life, and he gets hurt. Now, if it would have been him pinning Daniel Bryan after, let's say, a 20-minute match to open the gauntlet, it would have made even more sense for him, even if he then lost at the Chamber. You know, let's say Randy Orton eliminated him or Samoa Joe eliminated him. Anybody but Bryan. Okay? But if Ali had pinned Bryan here on this show, it would have made sense post-Elimination Chamber for him to say, look, I deserve a one-on-one match with Daniel Bryan for the championship because I have a win. Not only do I have a win, I have multiple wins over this man. Two pinfall victories over the champion he would have had, including that one tag team match. So I wonder if that was the plan. I wonder if that was the story they were going for. And then it would have possibly built to a championship match between Bryan and Ali. Maybe not a WrestleMania. I know that was the idea that I had pitched. But even at Fastlane, maybe it's just like a buffer until WrestleMania, you could have gotten away with doing Mustafa Ali against Daniel Bryan. But I guess, you know, who knows? Who knows if that was the plan or not? I tend to think it probably was. And, you know, look, I like a good underdog story. I think with the right person, it can work really well. I'm a big fan of that. But you know what's every bit as good? You know what works as good as a good underdog story? A good grizzled veteran story, which is what they did with Kofi Kingston. Now, Kofi's also an underdog, but he's the veteran guy who has been on the main roster now for 11 years. And he has never won a world championship. Kofi Kingston has never won the big one. He's been a tag team champion. I believe he's been both an IC and a US champion. But he has never been a world champion or a universal champion on either show. He's never won the big one. I would not mind seeing Kofi Kingston get the shock win and become WWE champion, even if he then goes and drops it back to Bryan a month later at Fastlane, which he probably would, you know, because there ain't no way that Kofi Kingston is going into WrestleMania as the champion. But, you know, to give him a short run with the belt, I don't think would hurt. Who does it hurt? You know, years ago, they did Jerry the King Lawler against The Miz on this very same pay-per-view, Elimination Chamber, back in 2011. They had a match for the WWE Championship, and I wanted them badly to put the title on Lawler, because they were telling the story with Lawler. He had been feuding for a couple months with Miz, and, you know, even though he's older and everything, Lawler is still very good. You know, at that time, he was still... Look, he's been doing this for 50,000 years. I mean, he's very good at this pro wrestling thing. And they were telling this good story, and I said, you know, give him a short token run with the championship. Lawler was never treated as anything serious in the ring in his WWE career. Obviously, in Memphis, he was a big deal for so long. But in WWE, he was never really highlighted or pushed seriously as a wrestler. And yet, all these years later, as an announcer, and yeah, babyface announcer, people would cheer for him, and they still cheer for him. You know, he's got this big following. Why not? Why not give Jerry Lawler, who held all these different championships in his career, and never any in WWE, give him a token win and a token run with the championship? He wouldn't take the title to WrestleMania. Or maybe he would, and drop it there, but my thought was, why not? Why not? He and Miz had this great TLC match on television not too long before that. But they didn't do it. Miz won, because Miz was the young guy they were pushing. So Miz won. They wanted to keep him strong going into his WrestleMania match, his crappy WrestleMania match with John Cena. But they thought about it. I remember at the time, reportedly, they did consider, Vince McMahon did seriously consider putting the championship on Jerry Lawler. They opted against doing it. They could very easily consider doing the same thing here with Kofi Kingston. But my prediction remains the same as it's been for, you know, the last few weeks since they announced this match. I don't see them taking the title off of Bryan before WrestleMania. I just don't see it. I think Daniel Bryan retains. And maybe it does come down to him and Kofi. With, you know, what a dramatic finish that could be. But I think what we're looking at here is 2012 all over again. It came down that year to a very unlikely final. World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Heel champion Daniel Bryan and Santino Marella, who, if I remember correctly, I think Santino was also a replacement for somebody who was injured. It might have been Randy Orton, actually, who was hurt. So Santino was the backup. He was never supposed to be in the chamber match. And it came down to Bryan and Santino. And I remember the crowd. They were so into... I mean, Santino was over anyway. But usually he's in the comedy segment. This was a freaking Elimination Chamber match for the World Heavyweight Championship. And people so badly wanted to see this guy win the title. Why? Because, first of all, when you have somebody who you genuinely like, you want them to win. But people dig the underdog story. It just works. You need the right person for it, but it just works. And then Daniel Bryan tapped him out in the LaBelle lock, and he broke everybody's heart. But I think that's the kind of situation we're looking for here. I think we see the same scenario play out this year, only it's Kofi Kingston in the same role that Santino had been in. But the sad part of this is that if Kofi were to win the championship in this match, he should win it off of his own merits. But the argument is going to be that the only reason they put the title on him is because it's Black History Month. It's the month of February. We've got Bobby Lashley as the Intercontinental Champion. We've got R-Truth as the United States Champion. And you know what? Those people would not necessarily be wrong. They would have every right to question WWE's motives in doing something like that. It's not like they haven't pulled that kind of stuff before. I mean, look, if after 11 years they give this guy a token run now, this month, I think you would be right to think that this company has ulterior motives in doing something like that. Even though Kofi has busted his ass for years, and I think he would be quite deserving, even if it was just a short run. At the very least, I think Kofi needs to avenge what Randy Orton did to him 10 years ago and eliminate this guy from the chamber match. Even though it's probably going to be AJ Styles getting revenge on Orton if they are setting up something between them, either at Fastlane or WrestleMania. But boy, it would be kind of sweet if Kofi got some kind of revenge on this SOB for what he did. If you can believe it, it's been a decade since Kofi hit the boom drop on Orton in Madison Square Garden. And then, of course, later on, Orton called Kofi stupid, killed his push. At least let the man get rid of Orton in this match. But anybody who's getting excited that this may finally be Kofi's time, man, he had this great performance on SmackDown on Tuesday night. He has been just underrated for so long. You know, maybe WWE is finally waking up. Maybe they're finally going to push this guy as a serious single star. All I can say is keep dreaming. I hate to burst your bubble, but it's not happening. Don't allow yourself to be fooled by what's going on here. Look, this has happened with other people before. And you allow yourself to think, well, maybe this is it. Maybe he's finally going to get a push. Maybe he's finally going to become champion. Maybe they're finally going to put some muscle behind this guy. And then invariably, they disappoint you. Because it's just not in the cards for these people. Some of these people have been with the company over 10 years. You know, I mean, it's like their old hat. And they're not somebody that is a priority for this company. They're not somebody they're going to focus on. But they kind of tease you and they allow you to think that, well, maybe finally this person is going to get their shot. And then they kick you in the nuts. Don't let them do that to you. Look at this for what it is. He lucked into a spot that was never intended for him. This was never meant for him. That is the reality. So no, I don't think this is the beginning of some kind of giant Kofi Kingston push. If WWE has not treated Kofi Kingston like a credible contender in 11 years, what makes you think that they're finally going to do it now? They had credible contenders last year in Braun Strowman for the Universal title and Samoa Joe for the WWE Championship. And they dropped the ball. How many times? I lost count of how many times Joe lost to AJ Styles. And he was in a far better position than Kofi Kingston or some of these other people to be the champion and get a run and carry the ball. And they didn't do it. But you think they're suddenly going to push Kofi Kingston? Are you new here? Maybe if he threatens to leave and go to AEW, then maybe all of a sudden he'll find himself getting a big push. Maybe that's the strategy here. You know, Steve from Dover. Dover where, he didn't say. Could be Dover, Delaware. Could be Dover, UK. This guy could be anywhere. But he listens to the podcast. He sent me an email. And he pitched the idea of having the chamber match come down to Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston. Big E and Xavier Woods would be outside the chamber, you know, to kind of counter Rowan and make sure that he doesn't interfere or he doesn't get involved. Somehow, though, Luke Harper returned. Now, Luke Harper was backstage at SmackDown Television this week. I don't know if he's officially cleared or not. I believe he is. He should be coming back very soon. You would have to think there's a pretty good chance he'll be affiliated with Rowan and Bryan in some way, maybe even aligned. But anyway, in his in Steve's email, he was proposing that it comes down to those two. You've got Big E and Kofi outside to counter Rowan. Somehow Luke Harper returns and gets inside the chamber. He helps Daniel Bryan retain the title. And that then would set up a six-man tag team match for Fastlane with The New Day against the Hipsters, as he calls them. With the stipulation that if the New Day wins, Kofi will get a one-on-one championship match with Bryan at WrestleMania. I think that would be a great idea. Kofi wouldn't win, but I think it would be a great idea, probably a great match. But the reality is Kofi Kingston is not getting a title match at WrestleMania any more than for all the people who mocked me for even the mere suggestion that Mustafa Ali somehow would get a championship match at WrestleMania, even though I at least tried to put forth some storyline sense and that he's pinned Bryan before. I guess now Kofi has too. So you can make the argument that he should get the shot. But it is no more or less ridiculous than the Mustafa Ali idea in that it's probably not going to happen. I know it's pie in the sky, but probably not going to happen. Kofi Kingston ain't going to WrestleMania to wrestle for or defend a championship. It's just not happening. It's nice to think about. Would be nice for him. I always dig a good underdog story. It ain't happening. I think there's a better chance that Kevin Owens is the guy to fight Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania. Kevin Owens was back on Raw this week in a vignette. They were showing him out bowling with his family. I'd rather watch 3 hours of Kevin Owens bowling than watch Monday Night Raw. But they showed him, he's out bowling with his family. He says he's about a month away from coming back. He doesn't know if he's going to go to Raw or SmackDown. And it sure does look like he's coming back as a babyface. Babyface family man Kevin Owens. I think he goes to SmackDown. I think he's the one to challenge Bryan for the championship at WrestleMania. This was just an insanely busy week. And so what we're going to talk about now is we have a new IWGP champion. Oh, by the way, there's some All Elite Wrestling stuff. I'll have to play my siren here to warn people before I start talking about that. And then there's some other scattered Raw thoughts from last Monday night, NXT. And, of course, number 8 in our WrestleMania countdown is coming up. Most shocking match outcomes in WrestleMania history. I've enjoyed the response so far. So a lot to get to. Only a month after Hiroshi Tanahashi won the IWGP Heavyweight title from Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom 13, in his very first defense, Tanahashi lost the championship to Switchblade Jay White at the New Beginning in Osaka show last Monday. I watched the match. I thought it was a very good match. White was toying with Tanahashi, slapping him around, just showing total disrespect. Went after Tanahashi's injured leg. That was the story of the match. Tanahashi responded in kind by doing the same thing to White and going after his knee. And at one point, Tanahashi transitioned from a cloverleaf into a Styles Clash for a near fall, which I thought was a pretty cool spot. Tanahashi went for a high fly flow. White caught him on the way down, dropped him with the Blade Runner, and won the championship. And I said on the prediction show that I did last month at the beginning of the year that I thought this was the year that Jay White would win the IWGP Championship. And there were a lot of people who thought it's too soon, maybe in 2020. But the way they've been pushing this guy and knowing that guys like Omega might leave and they might not have some of the talent that they've been pushing hard now for a while, it just felt like this was going to be the year. Now, I didn't know that it was going to be so soon in Tanahashi's first defense that he would lose. I didn't predict that. But I did think it would happen at some point this year. And look, it was pretty obvious that they were grooming him to be their next big, you know, Gaijin star. I think Sonata could be their next big native star. I've said that before, too. He's another name to watch for. I think he could be holding that title by sometime next year. I don't see it this year. But by 2020, you want to talk about who might be champion? Sonata is a guy to look at. But they've taken their time building up Jay White over the past year. You know, when he came back from excursion, he lost to Tanahashi at Wrestle Kingdom. That was Wrestle Kingdom 12. That was a match for the Intercontinental title. And he lost. And then following that, White won the United States Championship and lost the U.S. title as well. He lost it to Juice Robinson. But then over the summer, he picked up wins in the G1 over both Tanahashi and Okada. In fact, he was the only blemish on Tanahashi's record in all of the G1 last summer. Then they had Ghetto turn on Okada. They had been together. I mean, my God, Okada and Ghetto together were like Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman or Paul Bearer and The Undertaker. You know, for years, these two were together. They were a great combination. And Ghetto turns on Okada. He aligns with Jay White. Both of them, you know, join Bullet Club. Then he goes to Wrestle Kingdom just last month. He beats Okada clean. Jay White beats Okada clean at Wrestle Kingdom. And now he beats Tanahashi clean 1 month later in what I still think, look, some people may disagree. Some people may say, what does that even mean? I look at the IWGP Championship as the most, quote-unquote, valued title, valued world title in all of wrestling. The one that I look at and I feel, still feel special and still means something and is a really big deal if somebody wins it. That's how I look at the IWGP belt as opposed to the WWE title, the Universal title, which is a joke, or any other championship right now in wrestling. That's how I look at it. Winning the IWGP title is still a big deal. Some people will say, well, Jay White brings down the value of the title. He doesn't deserve it. It's too soon. He's too boring. He's too vanilla. They need to create new stars. They just lost Kenny Omega, at least for the time being. They lost Kenny Omega. They lost the Young Bucks. Cody wasn't doing much for them, but they lost him too. They've invested, and among others, by the way, it's not just Cody and the Bucks and Omega. They lost the Best Friends, Beretta and, and Chucky T. So they lost a number of people. They've invested a good amount of time in promoting this guy. I would have kept it on Tanahashi for the Madison Square Garden show. But I can understand them wanting to push this guy hard because they have to create a new star on that level. Kenny Omega told Dave Meltzer that the original plan, had he re-signed with New Japan Pro Wrestling, was for him to beat Tanahashi at Wrestle Kingdom, not lose. He would have beaten Tanahashi, and then he would have gone on to lose the IWGP title back to Okada in the main event of the Madison Square Garden show in April. According to Omega, that was the original plan. That would have been a far bigger match. Imagine them doing Okada-Omega. I mean, there's Okada-Omega burnout after a while, but to do that match at Madison Square Garden that weekend in front of a sold-out crowd, that would have been something else. That would have been something else. And I think it says a lot about the state of the relationship between Omega and New Japan right now that they could not reach a deal for him, even if he was leaving. Even if he said, look, I am going to be leaving or I might still leave. At least have him work through the Madison Square Garden show in April and drop the title to Okada. He's not wrestling his first match for All Elite until May 25th in Vegas when he wrestles Jericho. So in that respect, it would not have conflicted with any existing AEW dates. They could have worked something out conceivably to have him, you know, kind of extend his run and be there WrestleMania weekend to drop the championship. And I think it says something, and it's not good, about the state of affairs right now between Omega and New Japan that they just, I guess, couldn't come to an understanding. I know a lot of people are not sold on Jay White. I know he's not the most charismatic guy. He's not the flashiest guy. Although, you know, I wouldn't say he isn't charismatic. That would not be true. That's not fair. He plays the jerk heel very well. You know, he can think on his feet. I think back to the incident where he knocked Jim Ross, you know, by accident. But, you know, he was on that show where he went into the barricade or he threw into the barricade. And Jim Ross got knocked over. And I think he suffered broken ribs. Josh Barnett went after him and was almost trying to kill Jay White. And Jay White had to react. So it wasn't like he was, you know, on the spot apologizing for what happened. He even admitted in an interview recently that he spat at Josh Barnett. Barnett had turned around to go back to the announce table after coming after Jay White for real. And when he turned around, Jay admitted that he spat at him. And he said, thank God he didn't see me do that. Because if Josh Barnett saw that or got spit on by Jay White, that would have been the end of Jay White. That would have been it. We would be eulogizing Jay White, not crowning him as the new champion. And he's smart enough to know that. He kind of jokes about it now. So he plays the jerk heel very well. He's got a great story, too, that they really haven't told. When you look at where he is now and how he got here, he was on Talk Is Jericho recently. And I got to hear parts of his interview. And he said that, you know, he used to watch wrestling, but I guess he fell out of it for a while. But he was listening to the radio one day, and they were having a contest where you could call up and you could be entered into a random drawing for tickets to go to WrestleMania 27. So he entered, and he ended up winning. And then he and his best friend, all their accommodations are taken care of. They're getting flown out to Atlanta for WrestleMania. And it was there that he realized, hey, you know, I kind of want to do this. I really think I could do this. Because living in New Zealand, he says, look, I never thought I would have a chance to go to a WrestleMania. I never thought I would win a radio contest like this either. So, why not? Why can't I? So he starts training and he starts wrestling. He ends up meeting Finn Balor. This is back when Balor was still in his Prince Devitt days in New Japan. And Balor ends up recommending him for a spot as a young lion at the New Japan Dojo. He knew nothing of New Japan, but he moved out there to train and to learn, and they ended up sending him to the States on excursion. That's when he ended up working for Ring of Honor for a while. Eventually, he comes back to New Japan. He's got this Switchblade gimmick now. He starts beating some of the biggest names in the company. And now, the following year, he's the IWGP champion. And it all started with a radio contest for tickets to go to WrestleMania. I think that's a great story. Had he not told it on Talk is Jericho, I never would have known about it. I think he needs to tell that story more often. But New Japan has announced that the winner of the New Japan Cup this year, unlike in previous years where the winners earn the right, they could challenge for any title they want to. This year, the winner wins the right to challenge for the IWGP Championship at Madison Square Garden at the Ring of Honor New Japan show, the G1 Supercard, on April 6th. The New Japan Cup begins on March 8th. It extends all the way through March 24th. We already know one name in the tournament. That man is Kota Ibushi, who, right after I got done talking about what a commitment phobe this guy is, can never commit to one place, he's a freelancer, he bounces around, he goes and signs a 2-year contract with New Japan, like days after I just said this on the podcast. And it was the Super J-Cast that broke the news. He's been a freelancer pretty much his entire career up to this point. He spent all those years in DDT, he's wrestled now for a while in New Japan, but he's never been bound by a contract. You know, WWE wanted him badly. They brought him in for the Cruiserweight Classic, and he was incredible. He was the highlight of that tournament, him and Cedric. And he just would not commit. He was agreeable to come in and work other matches, which I think he did, but he would not sign a contract. I believe this might be the first contract he has ever signed. And now that he is, now that he's locked in, because I figured him for a shoo-in to go to All Elite, you know, to work with Omega. Kenny Omega still seems to think that he will end up at some point in All Elite. He's probably right, but for now, he's staying put. I think Ibushi or Okada win the New Japan Cup and challenge at MSG. I think it's got to be one of those two. I would like to see it be Ibushi. I mean, you have the story with Okada having been beaten at Wrestle Kingdom, trying to avenge the loss. He is still, I think, the biggest name New Japan could probably put in that match. So I get it if they want to go with Okada. I think that's fine. But I like the idea of Ibushi winning and him and Jay White wrestling for the championship at MSG. I think it could be a great match. White retains because I cannot see them having two short transitional title reigns back to back like that. I just don't see it. You've now had... Jay White was to lose this title at MSG, you're coming off basically a one-month run for Tanahashi where he defended the title successfully zero times. Now you're going to put the title on Jay White and have him drop the belt 2 months later? I suppose it could happen, but I just don't see it. Although, just thinking about this, how insane it would be with that crowd at Madison Square Garden if they could work something out. And they were able to get Kenny Omega to do a surprise run-in, let's say to fend off the Bullet Club, and help Ibushi win the championship. It's fantasy booking, I know. But what a tremendous moment that would be. Although I know it's unlikely. I do wonder if we might get a surprise appearance on that show, though, realistically, from Chris Jericho. We know Jericho's free to make his own deals with New Japan. He has said that. It's in his contract. He can just freelance himself and work with Ghetto, and they can come up with an idea on who he wants to wrestle next. He has said before, he's made no bones about the fact that he wants to work with Tanahashi. He wants to work with Okada at some point. Maybe the lights go out in the garden, and he attacks one of them to set up a future match. I just don't know that he would want to, or All Elite would want him to, work two different programs at the same time and take steam away from the match with Omega on that first big AEW show the following month. I could see All Elite not really being too thrilled about that, because right now they're all in promotional mode for that first show, you know, in Vegas. If it was a quick one-off surprise appearance at the Garden, you know, and then maybe they waited until later in the summer to revisit it, and then Jericho comes in sometime in July, August, or September to do a big match, I guess that could work. But I would expect some kind of surprise appearance on that show. And Jericho, look, he's done it before, right? Well, the last time we saw him at All In, the lights went out. When they came on, he was dressed up as Pentagon. So you never know what this guy's going to do. Speaking of All Elite Wrestling, there it is. Red alert. You've been warned. You've been warned. Tickets for Double or Nothing. Well, this is gonna piss some people off. Tickets for Double or Nothing sold out in just 4 minutes this week. That is the first ever same-day pro wrestling sellout in Las Vegas. That is now back-to-back sellouts in buildings of 10,000 or more for the Elite crew with no television, which is impressive. Now, I know there's been a lot of talk about scalpers and things of that nature. What will be more impressive to see is when they start running shows more frequently, instead of once every 8 months or so, if they can maintain this momentum, if they can go to places outside of Chicago and New York and Las Vegas and pack those buildings in. That's the best way, I think, to silence all of the hate that they're getting and show people who are skeptical and have a right to be skeptical, to show people that they're the real deal. Now, we're still several months away from that. The things I'm hearing about with regard to this possible television deal, if this pans out, the things I'm hearing, if this pans out, it's a game changer. But until they make some sort of official announcement, nothing else matters. Now, all things considered, for the people who are saying, yeah, scalpers and you know, bought up all the tickets, there aren't that many tickets out for this show on StubHub. I don't know about other websites. I know StubHub is sort of the main place for this. Based on what I saw yesterday, there aren't that many tickets out, all things considered. I counted just shy, I went section by section to see what's available as of yesterday, and I counted just shy of 2,000 seats available for this show. So in a building where they're going to pack in, what, 14,000? That doesn't sound too bad to me. I'm hearing some people, they're talking like there's 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 seats that are out there. Maybe there are. That's not what I saw, at least not on StubHub. That's not what I saw. Now, the top price, I had to check this out. I was curious what the top price is for the best ticket listed on StubHub for this show. You can sit, one person, front row, at Double or Nothing, at the MGM Grand, for $6,950. That's all. So if you have $7,000 just sort of sitting around, you can go to Double or Nothing, front row. Unless that ticket also buys you an equity stake in the company, yeah, I think I'm going to pass on that deal. I'm happy with my own ticket, thank you. If you do have tickets to Vegas, though, I know a lot of people got shut out. If you were one of the fortunate ones who wants to go to the show and you were able to get your ticket, I salute you. And I shall see you there, because I am going to Vegas as well. I will not pass up the opportunity to go to Vegas. I haven't been there very many times before, but when I've been there, I've always had fun. And when I heard about this, I thought, you know, hey, it's a fun way to spend a Memorial Day weekend. So I shall see you all there. In a surprise, The Undertaker was announced this week for StarCast 2. Now, some people are conflating these things. They think that StarCast is an AEW event. Officially, anyway, it's not. This is the convention that Conrad, I know, is running. He did it the first time in conjunction with All In. And obviously, it did well enough for them to bring it back again. And The Undertaker was the big announcement this week. He will be appearing at StarCast. I cannot believe that he got Conrad to pay the hourly rate that I talked about last week. I guess the mortgage business is treating him well. Undertaker is said to be charging for this event $60,000 for a 3-hour appearance at StarCast. $60,000 for 3 hours. So I guess Conrad got the reduced rate, not the $25,000 an hour rate. He's also charging, Undertaker is, $150 per photo. So if you want to get your picture taken with the dead man, as his old Big Evil theme music used to say, you're going to pay, right? That's what he used to say, right? You're going to pay, you're going to pay. I always thought that one line in the song where he said, always kicking asshole's ass. was very weird. I don't know if it was just me hearing that or if those are the actual words. I've not tried to look up the official lyrics to this song. That's what I always heard. That one line in the song. Always kicking asshole's ass. Just seems very repetitive. What a weird line. What a weird line to get away with, too, which makes me think maybe that's not what the guy's actually saying. Because they played that theme music on television. It was never bleeped or edited. Would they really be able to get away with that? Maybe they did. Anyway, Undertaker's wrestling contract. This is where a lot of this confusion is coming from. And people say, oh my God, Undertaker's going to be a double or nothing. His wrestling contract, supposedly with WWE, has expired. And that's why he's now able to make these kinds of appearances. We're hearing a lot more about him making convention appearances and doing signings and things of that nature. He is not on bad terms with WWE. He is not going to be appearing at Double or Nothing. He's not going to come out and kick Kenny Omega in the dick. But for now, it sounds like he may have wrestled his last match. I don't believe for a second that we have seen The Undertaker's final match in the ring. I don't buy that for a second. But do I believe that it may be the last match for a while, that he's not going to be at WrestleMania this year, that he may not wrestle on the Saudi show in May? Yeah, I can believe that. Just because he's not on the WrestleMania card this year doesn't mean he's retired. He's missed a couple of WrestleManias before. He could easily be back for a retirement match at WrestleMania 36, and maybe that's the year they put him in the Hall of Fame. So I don't buy that this is the end of The Undertaker, but it should be. It should be. And as much as I would hate for that Saudi Arabian debacle in October to be my lasting image of the Undertaker in the ring, it's time. It's been time for a while now. If we're being honest, Undertaker is a great entrance. His entrance, his theme music, raising the lights, pulling the hat off his head. It still gives people chills when he comes out and does that. And as somebody who's been to a whole bunch of WrestleManias, I can tell you that there's nothing better than an Undertaker entrance in a big stadium or a big dome at a WrestleMania. It's great. It would be great if he came out after he did his entrance and turned around and walked right back to the locker room. Because when the bell rings, it all falls apart. He can put on a capable match. I'm not calling him a cripple. I'm not calling him an invalid. What I'm saying is we have officially reached the point that he was always afraid of, which is I don't want to overstay my welcome and be the old guy who doesn't know when to hang it up. I don't want to embarrass myself. Well, I have nothing but respect for The Undertaker. The reality is he's embarrassing himself. You watch those last few matches, it is an embarrassment. I hate to think that that match, that tag team match, terrible as it was, would be his last match. But you know what? If it turned out to be, it's for the better. Because The Undertaker, who would go out there, even at his advanced age, and was all of a sudden, he almost had the second career for himself, the second half of his career where he was putting on great matches. You know, The Undertaker wasn't known for great matches when he first debuted. He was a gimmick. As time went on, though, he was allowed to, you know, show off his skills. And despite all the injuries that he's had, he was going out there in the mid to late 2000s and having some of the best matches in the company when he would appear. And some of the best WrestleMania matches. He was like turning back the hands of time. Well, at some point, Father Time catches up with you, and it caught up with The Undertaker. He should have stopped a long time ago. Speaking of older guys and whether or not they can still go, we might find out soon if Dave Bautista can still go. He is in talks for a possible match at WrestleMania 35. But there is also interest from All Elite Wrestling, and he is not turning them away. This is according to ProWrestlingSheet.com. They claim that Batista has been in talks with WWE about a possible match at WrestleMania. They do not say what match, but he's made it pretty clear in the past that he wants to wrestle Triple H. He wants to put over Triple H. Triple H or Brock Lesnar really are the only two names, when I think of Batista, who would make sense. You know, Batista against Randy Orton, does that really appeal to anybody? Not to me. I think it's either Brock or Triple H. And Brock's busy this year. He's already got some business to take care of at WrestleMania. So that only leaves one person. Triple H has been cleared to train. That does not mean he has been cleared to actually wrestle. He tore his pec in that tag team match at Crown Jewel a few months ago. And, you know, I was going to say, you know, it all comes down to whether or not Triple H is cleared or not. But then I realized who I'm talking about here, right? Who I'm talking about is not any other talent. It's not any other person. He's a part-time performer. Part-time performers, the company has made this very clear in the past, are not subject to the company's wellness policy and drug testing. Why should they be, you know, held to other standards like the other talent, like having to be cleared, having to go through this test and that test? They've admitted this already, that these guys are not subject to a lot of the same policies and standards that the full-time talent are. Point being, if Triple H wants to wrestle, whether he's 100% or not, if Triple H wants to wrestle at WrestleMania, you bet your ass that he is going to get his WrestleMania match. And if he has one, it looks like it may be with Batista, but Batista has to come to terms with them first. Now, according to the story, the way that the talks have gone so far, he's on the fence. He's 50-50 right now, whether or not he wants to come in and do it. At the same time, again, there's been interest from All Elite expressed to him from the All Elite side, and he is hearing them out. He has not turned them down, which would be stupid for him to do. Of course, you would want to hear them out, hear what the offer is, hear what they have to say. Chris Jericho, he knows what he's doing. He's trying to get people talking. He's trying to stir shit. He posted a photo on Instagram with Batista. The two of them either had lunch together or they went out to dinner together. And so he posted that photo on Instagram, and that got everybody talking. At the end of the day, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. I cannot see Big Dave finishing his career out anywhere but WWE. He has wanted that match with Triple H for years. He may finally have a chance to get it this year. And he still got his career in Hollywood. So I can't see him working matches for another company. To me, I look at this and wrestling for him, because he's got a good thing going with the movies. Wrestling to him is sort of a side thing. If I have time, I'd love to come back, and I have a name or two that I'd like to work with, but it's not where he's going to start signing contracts, I don't think, with other promotions. And people in some cases that he's never worked with. Now, he knows Jericho, and it's not like he doesn't know anybody who's going to be working in All Elite. And Jericho, I don't doubt that Jericho is probably part of the process here, working to try to recruit him. We'll see how convincing Chris Jericho can really be. I don't see Batista in AEW. Theoretically, though, there's nothing stopping him from doing both. He could conceivably work a WrestleMania match in April and then show up at Double or Nothing at the end of May. Maybe even if not to wrestle, maybe he's in the crowd, he's in Vegas, he's in town, so he's in the crowd and he waves, could be something like that. But to wrestle a match for them, I don't see that. We got some numbers on the first Impact Wrestling broadcast on the Pursuit Channel from last month. They did a little over 12,000 viewers for their very first show. Let me repeat that. 12,000 viewers on a network that boasts about how it's available in 40 million homes, which is why those numbers don't mean shit. Yeah, I've said that before. You have these networks. This network is available in up to 95 million homes. Yes, but that does not mean you're going to have 95 million people watching your show. If anything, I think it highlights how awful it is that if you're on a network, like a major network, you've got up to 100 million homes, right, that you're possibly available in, that have access to this channel. And you have a show that maybe doesn't even get a million on cable. Maybe it gets like 750,000. That's terrible. I wouldn't want to highlight that. But yeah, on a network that claims they're available in up to 40 million homes, they scored 12,000 plus for their very first. Now, it was the first show, and some people probably don't even know they moved. That's true. But my podcast is available to however many millions of people have internet access. That doesn't mean I have 300 million people actually listening to me. If I did, I could retire off of my Audible trials. 12,000 viewers for their first show, and somewhere around, I believe the number was 10 to 11,000 additional viewers off of their Twitch channel, since they air the show on Twitch as well. I don't know what the show does internationally. I know they have international TV deals, but just going off those numbers, the Sound Off has more weekly listeners than Impact has weekly viewers. At least the week of that first show last month. Maybe now they've built their audience back up to a respectable level. Again, this is going back to the debut episode on Pursuit. So at least as far as that time period is concerned, more listeners than Impact has viewers. Think about that. A company that once pulled over 2 million viewers on Spike TV, that was the night that Hulk Hogan debuted, now pulls 12,000 people on a channel that nobody has ever heard of before. Maybe that's an accomplishment, that nobody's ever heard of it and they still got 12,000 people to watch. I don't know. Maybe you got to look at the glass half full as opposed to the glass half empty. But how does that even happen? How do you go from that to this? How do you let it get that bad? Not hating here. I'm just stating. That's going to be my new t-shirt. Every time I get attacked for pointing out facts that people don't like to hear. Not hating, just stating. They've got an uphill climb ahead of them if they want to build an audience on that channel. Doing Twitch and TV at the same time is smart. It makes a lot of sense. They almost have to. But I don't know how this company generates enough of a buzz at this stage to really even make a difference. I am genuinely stumped. I don't know what they can do. I just don't know what they can do at this point. They've got some great talent. They've got LAX. They've got Pentagon and Phoenix. Killer Cross, who should be a star on a much bigger platform right now. You can add me to the list of people praising Killer Cross. I've been saying that since I first saw him pop up on Lucha Underground. The guy has a unique look. He can talk. He looks like a pro wrestler. They've got him, they've got Johnny Impact, they've got Sammy Callahan. Talent isn't the issue. I just don't know what else they can do other than exist. Raw was in Grand Rapids, Michigan this past week, and we had a show-long storyline. I want to make sure I talk about this, because this was the main story from Raw last Monday. Of the McMahons inviting Becky Lynch to Raw 1 week after she was suspended for refusing to allow their doctors to medically evaluate her. Okay? 1 week after she invaded SmackDown and slapped the COO across the face, they invited her back to TV. And they wanted her to apologize. They gave her all 3 hours to make her decision. Is she going to apologize? Is she not going to apologize? If she apologizes, she'll have her suspension lifted. And she can go to WrestleMania. If not, she throws away her WrestleMania opportunity. That was the question. Will she apologize? That's the storyline hook that they came up with to hook in viewers for 3 whole hours, which apparently didn't work because the numbers trended downward as the show went on, which is pretty much the Raw pattern every week. By the end of the show, she apologized. She said, "I'm sorry." In a week where Stone Cold Steve Austin said that he sees some of Becky Lynch in himself, or he sees some of himself in Becky Lynch, she told the McMahons, "She's sorry." You know, for someone who calls herself the man, she sure doesn't have the balls that Stone Cold did. Triple H and Stephanie, they were pleased with this. They went to go leave. All of a sudden, though, Vince McMahon comes out and said he wasn't so pleased. He said, "I don't accept your apology, and you and Ronda both have bad attitudes." And then she suspended Becky again, this time for 60 days, meaning she would be out of WrestleMania. And then he introduced Ronda's new opponent, her new challenger, Charlotte Flair. The video on WWE's YouTube channel of Charlotte being announced as Becky's replacement for WrestleMania, last I checked, on Saturday, had 26,000 thumbs up and 71,000 thumbs down. That is quite, that's off of over 1 million views. That is quite the ratio. That is quite the ratio. So let's recap this, shall we? First, they suspend Becky. She misses no shows. They invite her back the very next week. She apologizes, so she is therefore unsuspended. And then a few moments later, she's suspended again. Who writes this shit? Who writes this shit? Look, I don't disagree with the idea of stacking the deck against your top babyface to get the fans behind her even more, to give her some kind of a mountain to climb. And remember, they also have, what, 6 weeks? 7 weeks of television left to kill before WrestleMania? You gotta keep things interesting somehow. I understand that. Making people think Becky is screwed out of her WrestleMania match is smart. Putting heat on Charlotte is smart. Makes her one of the top heels in the company. But if the plan is for Becky to crash, let's say, Ric Flair's birthday party. Ric Flair's having this birthday party. Out of nowhere, they started promoting this is going to be a big television event. Not this Monday, next Monday in Atlanta. Ric Flair's 70th birthday party. Live on Monday Night Raw. If the plan is for Becky to crash Ric Flair's birthday party, which I have to assume it is, why else are they doing it? They had Becky, last night, they had Becky hop the barricade at a live event in Alexandria, Louisiana, and go after Charlotte during her match with Asuka, who is in fact still among the living. WWE.com had a story up saying that Charlotte re-injured her knee. She re-injured the man's knee last night. They posted video of Charlotte attacking Becky's injured knee with a chair. This all happened at the house show last night. So that's going to be part of the story. And I like it when they do stuff like that. So I guess that'll be part of the story they'll tell on television this week. I'm sure they'll show highlights of that as well on TV. I still think she crashes the party next week. Even if she's quote-unquote re-injured, I think she still crashes the party next week. Dress her up as a clown, have her pop out of the cake, whatever. Whatever it is, she should crash that party. Hell, she should threaten to break Ric Flair's arm if her suspension isn't lifted. But why have her apologize? Yeah, you could say, well, it makes sense. It makes sense, but she has to apologize to the McMahons. She was already suspended. Why not have her be defiant and keep her pride and stay suspended? And then crash Flair's party in 2 weeks anyway and get the suspension overturned. They could have added Charlotte. They could have done everything that they've done so far without having her apologize. She was already suspended. You had her say, "I'm sorry," just to suspend her all over again. But here's the other thing that stunned me watching this. That the crowd gasped. Where were they? Grand Rapids, Michigan. They gasped at Vince McMahon's announcement that he was suspending Becky for 60 days. They gasped at this announcement 1 week after they shot a suspension angle in which Becky missed exactly zero television shows. That crowd reaction is one of the reasons why they are allowed and can get away with spoon-feeding us this kind of shit. Because despite the fact that these suspensions amount to nothing, the sheeple will continue to lap it up. It's laziness. But it's excusable because the people react. It's like ringing the bell. The Pavlovian response. And as long as people continue to do that, then they can get away with it. Now, one question is, will they repeat the same formula from WrestleMania 30? And would they have a scenario? Because we all know Becky's going to WrestleMania. We all know Becky's going to win the championship. She's sure as shit better. But how do they get there? How do they get there? Is it going to be a triple threat match? Will it ultimately be a singles match? And this is all just one big swerve, just for the sake of getting people all fired up. Would they repeat what happened at WrestleMania 30 and open the show with Becky Lynch in a singles match against, say, Stephanie McMahon? With the stipulation that if Becky wins, she then gains entry into the main event. It would be a carbon copy of what they did with her husband and Daniel Bryan in New Orleans 5 years ago. Was it 5 years ago now? Was it 5 years ago? Wow, what's 5 years ago? Jeez. Time just seems to be moving along, man. Wow. Anyway, it just feels too soon. 5 years is a long time, I guess, but still, it's too soon, I think, to repeat the exact same formula. I think it could work. I guess it's a way for them to go. It just feels too soon to me. Now, I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the Elimination Chamber predictions, there was a tweet that was put out by the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which has broken some things before. And they talked about there being a planned merging, in effect, of the women's rosters from Raw and SmackDown. There's going to be more of a mixing. There will not be a formal brand split, really, with the women anymore, which would make sense with them introducing one set of tag team titles. So it would stand to reason that there would be hardly any real brand split anymore where the women are concerned. One question that comes out of that, if that turns out to be true, would they go the unification route for WrestleMania instead and leave Asuka the odd woman out of the title picture going into the show? Would Asuka drop the championship in advance of WrestleMania, or maybe even at WrestleMania at the beginning of the show or something, and to Becky, and let's say Becky goes in and now both titles are on the line in the main event? That would piss a lot of people off, I think, who want Asuka to be in a more prominent position at WrestleMania, but don't necessarily want a fatal four-way, right? I don't hear too many people clamoring for a repeat of WrestleMania 2000. As far as options go for Asuka, there aren't very many good ones out there. A crossover match for the championship with Ember Moon from Raw would have been, I think, great, except that Ember Moon just had elbow surgery, and I don't think she's going to be ready in time for WrestleMania. You have Naomi. A match with Naomi, I think, you know, that could be good. I see it as a step below where Asuka should be at WrestleMania, but sure, I mean, they used to be a tag team, so there's a history there. I guess that could work. I think I would be more interested in an open challenge. If they have no other ideas, good ideas for Asuka, an open challenge, not even knowing who her opponent is going to be until the night of the show. Then, of course, they have to deliver. They can't give us a dud. But have it be an NXT star. Have it be a Shayna Baszler or a Kairi Sane. You know, somebody tweeted me and suggested, why not Minoru Suzuki as Asuka's opponent? He certainly has a history with Asuka, if you've seen it on YouTube. A very uncomfortable history, if you ever saw the match that I'm referring to. Yeah, you know, WWE had to cancel the planned Dean Ambrose-Nia Jax match that they were going to do at that live event in Arkansas next week, later this week, because of pressure from one of their sponsors. I think if they booked Minoru Suzuki against Asuka, they would have no more sponsors. But in a perverse kind of way, I'd like to see it. But it's been 3 weeks since anybody has seen Asuka on television. 3 straight episodes of SmackDown without their women's champion, who was last seen tapping out the eventual Royal Rumble winner at the Royal Rumble. Becky Lynch, everything's surrounding Becky Lynch right now. She's in the top storyline of the company, and the woman who tapped her out is nowhere to be found. That house show last night in Alexandria where Becky did the run, and that was the first reference I've seen to Asuka since the Royal Rumble. Last week, I said Dean Ambrose was acting like a babyface on television. Wasn't sure if that was meant to be that way or not. But this week, we got our answer. Yes, Dean Ambrose appears to be a babyface once more. He also, according to Meltzer, did not like the promo that was originally scripted for him for his segment with Seth Rollins. He just supposedly wasn't feeling it. All the stuff they wanted him to say about the Shield and their history together and Roman Reigns. So he kept it short. He came out, he looked Seth in the eye, and he said to him, go slay the beast. Short and to the point. I liked it. Let Ambrose write this show. Offer him a new contract and let him write Monday Night Raw. He beat EC3, another short nothing match with an inside cradle. Much the same way that EC3 beat him the week before. You know, this is how you get people over these days. This is their great idea. This is how they get people over now. 50-50, small package, inside cradle, fluke wins. What have they done to EC3? Are you kidding me? This guy is a mute. He hasn't said a word. Now he's losing to roll-ups? How do you screw up EC3? What the fuck is wrong with these people? The Revival finally beat Roode and Gable to win the Raw Tag Team titles. This show was deader than dead at this point. These guys were put in the death... I mean, this whole show is a death spot, but they were put in the death spot. And by the end of this match, they got the crowd alive again. They resuscitated them, brought them back to life. That's what a great wrestling match can do. What a great match this turned into. That's what happens when you work 30 to 40 minute matches together on house shows every night, which is what they've been doing. It may have been an unadvertised match on the go-home show to a pay-per-view where they're not even scheduled to wrestle, at least as of this moment. Maybe they'll add something at the last minute, but they're not even on the show tonight. And it may have been in front of a crowd that was library silent until the closing minutes, but you know what? The Revival finally got the titles. The lesson, of course, in all of this is just ask for your release, and good things will happen. Because you're either going to get your release, or you'll become the tag team champions. Or as Dash Wilder tweeted, he really tweeted this yesterday, complain long enough and you can achieve anything. Those are words to live by. Although if that's true, how come Raw still sucks most weeks? I've been complaining about this show for years. SmackDown. Let me calm down here. SmackDown. Yeah, it's funny. I watch Raw on Monday night, and sometimes there's good stuff. A lot of time there's absolutely terrible stuff. And I get all animated and I say, I gotta calm down. I gotta compose myself. What am I gonna talk about on Sunday? What do I not want to talk about? And then it all comes rushing back to me. It all comes rushing, when I look at my notes and I think back to what happened on Monday night, it all comes rushing back to me and it pisses me off all over again. Like a flashback. SmackDown this week, at least, was a very enjoyable show. Even the Charlotte promo at the beginning, I thought she did a hell of a job. She's a great heel. She's very hateable, which is why, for so long as the babyface, I said, this woman is miscast. They had a couple of different people who were miscast. Bobby Roode, for God's, I mean, he's got a nice thing going with Gable now, I guess, but this guy was miscast from day one. Charlotte as a heel is in the role she belongs in. She just doesn't need to be in the main event of WrestleMania, but that's a different story. But that was a good segment. You know, the stuff with Miz and Shane and the Usos, I thought was good. And then we had the gauntlet match. Now, Kofi Kingston, as I said earlier, he was a replacement for the injured Mustafa Ali. It sucks for Ali. What an opportunity for him to be in a match with all these big names. He gets hurt. He's not medically cleared. He's out of the chamber tonight. What do? They put Kofi Kingston in his place. Kofi Kingston is the grizzled vet here. He's been in this company over a decade. He's been part of the New Day act for a while now. Great wrestler, but it's a comedy act. Let's just be honest. They walk out with a plate of pancakes every week. It's hard to take those guys seriously. But they put Kofi Kingston in this gauntlet, and by the end, that's all anybody was talking about when this show was on. It was the Kofi Kingston show. He started the gauntlet out with the WWE champion. He went 25 minutes with Daniel Bryan, and he pinned him. And then he beat Jeff Hardy, and then he beat Samoa Joe. He beat everybody except AJ Styles and Randy Orton in this gauntlet. He went an hour, Kofi Kingston did, until he finally got pinned. Now, I don't think he has a realistic shot to win the championship tonight, but I wouldn't hate it if he did. I still think it's probably a Santino situation, like I said earlier, from 2012, where it may come down to him and Bryan. I think it should come down to him and Bryan. I don't see any reason for it not to. He pinned Daniel Bryan in the gauntlet. He has established the fact that he can beat the champion. He's the big underdog story. He is what Mustafa Ali would have been in this Elimination Chamber match. Why get rid of him early? He should be there at the very end, like Santino was when the last time we saw heel Daniel Bryan as the world champion in a chamber match. Came down to those two, he snuffed out everybody's hopes and dreams by tapping him out to the bell lock. And I see a similar situation unfolding tonight. But I wouldn't hate it if they went the other way just to shock people or to throw Kofi a bone. Look, I just think anybody thinking that WWE is going to finally push Kofi Kingston as anything but a middle-of-the-card act after 11 years on the main roster is fooling themselves. If they think that he is worthy of the chance, then it should not have taken them 11 years to figure that out. He could win the title tonight, but I don't think people should get ahead of themselves and think that even if he does, even if that happens, that it's part of any kind of long-term plan and it's a turning point in the career of Kofi Kingston. I think that ship sailed long ago. Sad tweet this week. Take your fucking pick. Jesus. I'll go with one that you probably didn't see. Most people didn't see because he took it down very quickly. Sad tweet goes to Lars Sullivan. He pulled the old tweet and delete. Maybe he was just trolling. It's possible this was just him trolling, but this would hardly be the first weird thing that he's posted on the internet. On Valentine's Day, Lars tweeted that, now again, he has been MIA, right? We heard the stories about him having a panic attack or some kind of mental health issue, and the company sort of danced around it. They haven't denied it, but they haven't really come out and said what happened, and he was all primed to attack John Cena and all that, and he has just been off the grid. And he tweeted, "After months of reflection, I have decided to join the Church of Scientology." Then he quickly deleted it. Sad tweet indeed. Imagine going from a possible WrestleMania feud with John Cena to tweeting about Scientology. Unless he suddenly debuts in the next couple of weeks, this guy may go down as one of the biggest crash and burn stories in company history. Or can you even crash when you haven't lifted off yet? NXT, I just want to briefly mention from NXT this past week, there was a match, the Street Profits had a match against Humberto Carrillo and the newcomer Stacy Irvin Jr. This was a way more aggressive Street Profits than we've seen before, especially Montez Ford, almost heel-like, I would even say. He hit Stacy Irvin with a back suplex at one point that looked like he broke the guy. I mean, you hear references to, oh, he folded him in half. He folded this guy in half. I thought he broke his neck. Absolutely brutal. They won with a super blockbuster out of a Doomsday Device position. After the match, they talked about wanting a shot at the tag team titles. This is what we need to see more of out of these two. More aggression, more fire. Just don't break anybody's neck. But this is the sort of thing I'd like to see more of from the Street Profits. We had Marcel Bartel and Fabian Aichner came out. They objected to what the Street Profits said about wanting the tag team titles. Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan came out. Finally, the War Raiders, the tag team champions, came out. They basically said, bring it, until they were attacked from behind by the Undisputed Era. The tag team division on NXT right now is light years ahead of Raw and SmackDown. I don't even think it's debatable at this point. And then in the main event, they had Ricochet beat Adam Cole. Another great match. These two are fun to watch together. Undisputed Era attacked Ricochet after the match until Aleister Black tried to make the save. He too was put down, and that now sets up a tag team match. So those are the just brief thoughts I had on NXT this week. We'll do an abbreviated mailbag and then get into the WrestleMania countdown because I can't go too long here this week. But again, if you have questions, you could always email them to me. I do see everything you send. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We've got Rob in Indianapolis. With the rumors of dumping the brand split in the women's division and the potential of unifying the two titles, do you think there is the potential of doing a McMahon in every corner elimination match like WrestleMania 2000? You have Vince supporting Charlotte, Triple H and Stephanie backing Ronda and Becky after what happened this past Monday. And then maybe Shane comes out in support of fellow SmackDown star Asuka. It's not the one-on-one with Becky and Ronda that I want, but if you make them the final two, we get our one-on-one moment and Vince gets to add Charlotte. I pray that this is not what we get. I hated the McMahon in every corner nonsense 20 years ago when they did it the first time. To recreate it now is just completely unnecessary. These women don't need it. They don't need it. Yes, it would get Asuka in the main event of a WrestleMania, but once she's eliminated, first or second, and you know she would be, people would just bitch and complain anyway about her being mistreated. Oh, she should have won. Oh, she should have been in the final two. I got news for you. If they do a fatal four-way, it ain't coming down to Asuka and Becky or Asuka and Ronda Rousey, which at some point I think could be a great match. But that's not happening. If we did need McMahon influence in this match, and let me just stress, we do not. This match does not need to be stained by having a McMahon out there. But use them to put more heat on the match in the build-up if you want. But when April 7th rolls around, this match does not need a McMahon in every corner. It just doesn't. But if they're going to do it, you ask the question. If they're going to do it, I would prefer it be a three-way, not a four-way. Be a three-way with Vince supporting Charlotte and Triple H and Stephanie supporting Ronda. Which would be quite the 180 from a year ago. Then you have Becky Lynch out there as the rebel without a McMahon. Becky Lynch, of all people, should not have a McMahon in her corner. She shouldn't be on TV apologizing to them either. But that's already been done. She should not have a McMahon in her corner. If she wants, she can troll Vince and invite his brother Rod to sit in the front row. Put Rod McMahon out there. You make the match elimination rules. That way Charlotte taps out first to Ronda, and they could go a good 20, 25 minutes before Charlotte even gets eliminated. Charlotte has a price to pay for what she did storyline-wise to Ronda back at the Survivor Series. She laid a beatdown on that woman. So it would make sense that Ronda gets her revenge by tapping out Charlotte in the armbar. Then it comes down to the match that everybody wants to see. One-on-one. Ronda Rousey and Becky Lynch. And Becky beats Ronda to win the championship. Don't get me wrong. As a match, I think it will be better with Charlotte in there. I'm not saying it makes the actual match worse. As a match, I think it'll be excellent. But if that's the criteria for putting her in the main event of WrestleMania, oh, we want to have a great match, then we would have had people like Kofi Kingston and Dolph Ziggler and all these other people in the WrestleMania main event long ago. It's the match that you think will draw. Which in this case, and you could clearly see it the night after the Royal Rumble, when they went face to face, that match is Becky Lynch versus Ronda Rousey. Not Becky, Ronda, and Charlotte. No matter how good of a heel troll she may be on TV. John says, I want to know if you know anything about the ring sizes then and now. Looking back at the Ruthless Aggression era, the rings seem longer and bigger than today's rings. I know it's 20 by 20 now. What were the ones before? 20 by 20. I mean, to my knowledge, WWE rings have always been 20 by 20, going back at least to the 90s. I mean, I don't know what they would have been in the 70s, but at least going back to the 90s, it's always been a 20 by 20 ring. I don't think they've changed in size unless, you know, they may use smaller rings for certain live events in smaller venues. But the standard WWE ring is 20 by 20 and always has been. WCW rings were smaller. Those were 18 by 18. I think ECW and TNA also used 18 by 18. Although, I was at a TNA house show once at Webster Hall. Of all places, you talk about unique venues to have a wrestling show. This giant just dance club, this dance hall, different levels, have different genres of music. And, I mean, I haven't been to Webster Hall, I don't think, since. But they had a wrestling show. They put a wrestling ring in there, and you had very few rows of seats up on this platform, on this stage, because the ring was raised. Most of the people were just standing down below in the pit area, like if you were at a concert. So it wasn't like formal seating unless you paid to sit in the first five rows around the ring like I did, because I wasn't standing in that pit and taking my life into my own hands. But that ring that they used on that show was the smallest ring I have ever seen in my life. This thing, I mean, realistically, 15 by 15, but I'm guessing even smaller than that. These guys didn't have room to do anything. How Kurt Angle and Christian even had a match in the main event, I'll never know. It wasn't until the late 90s that WWE finally softened their rings. They did make a big change in the mid to late 90s. I think the late 90s, where they made them softer. Because for years, guys were complaining about how it felt like concrete whenever they would take a bump. Those rings they used in the 80s and the early 90s were fucking brutal. Absolutely brutal. There was no give, no bounce like there is today. Go back and look at some of those old rings back then, late 80s, early 90s. Ugh, no wonder those guys were getting hurt all the time. No wonder they were all hooked on pills. Imagine taking bumps in that ring every single night.
What did we just see? What did we just see? It's WrestleMania, baby!
Top 10 most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes continues. Last week, it was the Fatal 4-Way at WrestleMania 2000 with a McMahon in every corner. Number 8 this week brings us back to WrestleMania 7 and the career-ending match between the Macho King Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warriors back in 1991. And you might be asking, well, you know, of the two, Savage losing really wasn't much of a shock. No, but the way he lost and what happened immediately after is what was shocking. The list is match outcomes. Remember that, not just match finishes. First of all, this is one of my favorite WrestleMania matches of all time. It led immediately into one of my, if not my favorite all-time WrestleMania moment. Maybe not the moment, but one of my probably top three all-time Mania moments. This was during the period where Randy Savage, after beating King Duggan, Hacksaw Jim Duggan was a king, believe it or not, who beat King Haku, so quite the lineage here for that crown. He was walking around now as the Macho King. Ted DiBiase even had a golden scepter made as a gift for him. I loved it when they would have these segments, like the coronation when Savage was crowned king. You had all the heels. I think the Genius, his brother, was actually the one who was sort of emceeing the segment. But all the heels would all gather together, like a bunch of evil supervillains. So yeah, DiBiase had the scepter made for him, and Savage feuded with Dusty Rhodes that year, the following year, and he feuded with the Ultimate Warrior. The fall of 1990 is when it all began. Warrior refused to sign a contract from Sensational Sherry that would have granted Savage a championship match. Warrior was WWF champion at the time. Savage wanted a title shot. Warrior wouldn't give it to him. Fast forward to Saturday night's main event a few months later. It's the Warrior against the Million Dollar Man, and Savage attacks the Warrior with the scepter, leaves him laying. Fast forward to the Royal Rumble, 1991. Warrior is scheduled to defend the WWF title that night against the American turncoat, Iraqi sympathizer, Sergeant Slaughter. But not before. This is when they were doing their whole, the whole Gulf War angle, which is one of the more, you know, stupid things that they've done. Claiming that they had to move WrestleMania that year from the 100,000-seat LA Coliseum to a 15,000-seat sports arena because of bomb threats when they... Oh, there was a bombing, all right. They bombed in ticket sales. That's why they moved the show. But anyway, so it's Warrior against Savage, or Warrior against Slaughter, rather, here at the Rumble. That is the scheduled match for the championship. But, not before one last attempt to get the Warrior to agree to grant Savage a title shot if he retained the championship over Slaughter. Savage already had a commitment from Sergeant Slaughter that if he won the title, he was going to give Randy a title shot. He wanted the same assurance from the Warrior. So what did he do? He sent Sherry out there to the stage, to the interview platform with Mean Gene. And Sherry went all CM Punk on us there for a bit. She was about to let us in on some kind of secret about the Ultimate Warrior that we didn't know. When she was interrupted by his theme music, it cut her off and out he came. I still want to know what Punk was going to say about Vince's anti-bullying campaign before they cut his mic. on a realistic level, okay, what do you think he would have said had they not cut his mic like they were supposed to, right? Because he's coming up with this stuff on his own. Here's what I'm going to say and everything. And okay, when I say this, you know, you interrupt me, you cut my mic. I'm sure that's the way the whole thing was structured. But let's say they didn't cut his mic. Let's say they were ribbing him and they just wanted to let him keep talking. Right? Like, what examples would he have given? What would he have said, do you think, about Vince and the anti-bully? Because obviously it's the funniest thing in the world that you have a guy like Vince McMahon spearheading an anti-bullying campaign. It's got to be Jim Ross, I would think, right? That's got to be the example number one that Punk would have given. Who was bullied by Vince McMahon more than that guy? It's got to be JR. Anyway, Sherry tries to seduce the Ultimate Warrior. Now, 9-year-old me is watching this at the time. I have no idea how sexual this all is, right? The sexual overtones here, looking back, are ridiculous. Sherry gets down on her knees for the Warrior like she's about to fillet the man. So long as he grants the Macho King a title shot, she'll do whatever he wants. And it is funny to watch it back, because I watched it back recently, heading into the Rumble a few weeks ago. I was watching a lot of old Royal Rumble stuff. And it is funny watching it back how the crowd erupted for this. Like, as soon as she starts to get down on her knees, it just erupts into cheers. But this proved to be a very poor decision. The Warrior said no. He said no. And this proved to be a very poor decision on his part, because Savage ended up interfering in his match later. He broke the scepter over his face, and he cost him the championship. This led to the career-ending match here at WrestleMania between the Warrior and Savage. Loser would have to leave the company. They'd have to retire. Their in-ring career would be over. Now, there have been a lot of stories about why Savage was taking time off at the time, that he and Elizabeth were going to try to start a family, and he had to get off the gas. There's other stories. He just, the company just wanted to give him time off, and when he came back, he'd be fresh as a babyface, whatever the reason was. I would think that most people at that time going into the show probably figured that the Warrior was going to win this. He's the babyface. Savage is the heel. Savage cost him the championship. This is Warrior's revenge. So I don't know that the outcome of the match was unpredictable or anything like that, but they had what was the greatest match of the Ultimate Warrior's career. And he didn't do much. This was the Randy Savage show here. And this was only his second match back for Savage after suffering a broken thumb. He broke his thumb 2 months before. He had only one house show match the week before WrestleMania, which was a cage match victory over the Ultimate Warrior. I'm not even sure he was fully healed yet from the broken thumb. But I count four surprising things that happened here during and after this match. So predictable as the outcome itself may have been, there are four things that I found surprising, if not shocking. Number one, Savage hit his big elbow drop off the top and the Warrior kicked out. All right, that's not too surprising. Well, he didn't just hit one. He didn't hit two. He didn't hit three. He hit five elbow drops off the top rope, and the Warrior still kicked out. Nobody had ever kicked out. I don't even know if they kicked out of more than one. If they did, it was certainly not more than two. He kicked out of five big elbows. Number two, after the Warrior knocked Savage out of the ring, he hit him with a shoulder block, knocked him out of the ring. He went outside, or he reached outside, grabbed Savage, pulled him back in. And how did he beat him? He placed his foot on top of Savage's chest and he pinned him. He beat this man with a foot on the chest after a shoulder tackle. That's how the Macho Man's career, for the time being anyway, that's how the Macho Man's career ended. That was shocking. Then came the post-match. Sherry had been with Savage since the summer of 89, after he lost the championship, and basically, at the time, he dumped Elizabeth, or, I should say Elizabeth dumped him, thanks to that homewrecker, Hulk Hogan. Homewrecker Hogan. Now you know what he means when he signs HH at the end of all of his tweets. So once she lost her meal ticket here, Sherry did, right? Her man just lost. He's got to leave. What's she going to do? She lost her shit. She kicked her heels off. She starts kicking Savage in the rib, literally kicking a man while he's down. Kicking him in the ribs. The crowd is booing. Savage had been a heel for a couple of years now. People now are having sympathy for him, what this woman is doing to him. Sherry was awesome, by the way, as just a manager. You talk about people. I was talking earlier about Pedro Morales, and the man was the world champion for 1,027 days, and you never hear about him. WWE never acknowledges him, never talks about him really in hardly any capacity, other than, some fleeting little highlights here when they put some big video together. But you would think that the guy almost didn't even exist. He doesn't get the credit that he probably deserves. Sherry's another one, very underrated. Sherry does not get talked about. I know she's in the Hall of Fame and she's been acknowledged, but she doesn't get talked about enough how freaking good she really was. So she's going after Savage now. She's kicking him. She's, you know, ramming his head down into the mat. And this leads to shocker number four here. Elizabeth, who on television had been broken up with Randy for the last 2 years. She was planted in the crowd for this match. She's watching this all go down. The camera keeps cutting back and forth to her. You could see the emotion just about to boil over. And finally, she's had enough. She's seen enough. She cannot take any more. She hops the barricade, runs into the ring, grabs Sherry by the hair, and tosses her out to the floor. The place is going nuts for all of this. The first time that they showed Elizabeth sitting in the crowd at the start of the match, it was probably pretty obvious at that point where this was headed. But going into the show, I don't think there was a single mention of her even being there. Her being there was a surprise. Her mere presence that night was a surprise to the audience. But that Savage started the night as one of the top heels in the company with, you know, Scary Sherry as his manager, and ended it as a retired babyface, reunited with his lady. That was shocking. And that was great storytelling is what that was. That was great long-term storytelling. That was a great payoff. Everybody won in this situation. The Warrior won the match, so he gets the win, and he gets to keep his career. Savage, although he lost, got his woman back and got to celebrate as this great hero, getting this great farewell from the audience. The fans loved it. This was great in every way. Every which way you slice it, this was just picture perfect here, what they did here. Got the two of them reunited in the center of the ring. They celebrated together. Savage even did something that he never used to do. It was always Elizabeth he would have hold the ropes open for him. This time he held the ropes open for her. Just a great ending. And some people may have seen it coming, but not everybody. And when they did, they cheered like I did. Now, I didn't cry like these women in the crowd that Bobby Heenan was making fun of, which was even better. He's got one woman. He said, well, maybe her shoes are too tight. Then they show another woman, tears streaming down her face. Maybe she had the chili dog with onions. You don't know. That was actually not Savage's last match before he transitioned to being an announcer. He wrestled again. He wrestled two more matches. Both in Japan, as part of this big interpromotional tour. There's an interpromotional agreement with WWE and this company called SWS, which was short-lived. I think it only lasted 2 years, but it was called SWS. Sport something, I forgot what it stood for. But on that tour, the first show was... Now, again, keep in mind, this is a week or two after WrestleMania. They're in Japan. The first show was at the Tokyo Dome. And Savage won his match that night. The second show was not at the Tokyo Dome. I know it was at a smaller venue, but he wrestled Tenryu. And he lost. Got powerbombed and he lost. That was the same show where Koji Kitao wrestled Earthquake and started shooting on him midway through the match. I don't know if I might have told this story before. This guy, Kitao, he would not sell any of Earthquake's offense. Now, they had a match on the first show, and seemingly it went well. And Earthquake won with the big splash. He sat on him and pinned him, and so this was the rematch. He would not sell for any of Earthquake's offense. It was actually a boring match. It's almost like watching a boring UFC fight, because you had two guys here. Once Earthquake figured out what was going on here, he wanted to protect himself. Neither one wanted to make a move. So, 3/4 of the match, they're standing in a defensive position waiting for the other to make a move. That's not exciting pro wrestling. But Earthquake is a legit sumo. He had a legit sumo background. He is the wrong guy to fuck around with. He was not taking any of this guy's shit. You could hear Earthquake. He's cursing at him. At one point, you see, you know, you can read his lips. He's like, what are you doing? This is pro wrestling. He's trying to, and this other guy, just stoic look on his face, not saying a word. It was amazing to watch, but Earthquake was having none of this guy's shit. And if you search for the video online, there's video of both matches. Again, the Tokyo Dome match ends with Earthquake winning with the squash. That's not what this match was. This is the match where things went south is the second one. That's the one you want to look for. But Katao just lost his mind. Katao is the one they brought in to team up with Tenryu at WrestleMania 7. That's the only reason I even remember the guy. He actually wrestled at WrestleMania 7 a couple weeks before this. That was part of the working agreement. They brought him and Tenryu in as a tag team, and they got a win over Demolition. This asshat got a win over Demolition. What a disgrace. Then a few weeks later, here he is. He's shooting on one of their wrestlers. He grabs... Oh, that's not even the end of it. he does this, right? And they award the match to Earthquake. Earthquake raises his arms in the air. He's declared the winner. Katao grabs a microphone, and this is not in the video, unfortunately, but he grabs a microphone after the match is over, and he starts yelling that pro wrestling is fake. All the wrestlers have to come out to restrain him to get him off the mic. He's yelling, pro wrestling is fake, because they awarded the match to Earthquake. So he wanted to tell people, hey, it's fake, I could beat this guy in a real fight. And finally, the wrestlers, they wrestle the mic away from him, and he gets fired. So just an interesting little side story there on that that last Japanese show, the one where Savage actually wrestled his final match before he went off into temporary retirement. Savage, of course, as you all know, he did come back to the ring later that year after his made-for-TV wedding to Miss Elizabeth at SummerSlam, who he was already married to in real life. And after, it's funny, after being, it's not funny, I shouldn't say it's funny, it's actually sad that after being married in real life for so many years, they have this fake wedding on television, and then less than a year later, they get a very real divorce. Oh well. But yeah, Savage and Liz, two people gone far too early. So this segment will be posted, as all of these segments are, on Wednesday on the YouTube channel. It'll be clipped, and I will have all of them organized in a playlist so that when the countdown is over, you can always refer back to the individual segments in one spot, in one playlist. So that's where you can find it. And, of course, the playlists are also up for the top 9 WWE promos countdown, the retro one that we just wrapped up this past week. We're going to be starting a new retro countdown on the YouTube channel on Friday. And the other countdown that I did, the top... what was the countdown? The Royal Rumble. Top 10 Royal Rumble Championship matches. All of those individual segments are organized in a playlist on the YouTube channel. We've got over 47,000 subs. We are on our way to 50,000, but I can't do it without your help. So if you are not subbed, please go ahead and do so. I will have my Elimination Chamber review going up later tonight, early tomorrow morning on the YouTube channel as well. Another reason to go ahead and subscribe. So that way, as soon as it goes up, you should hopefully get the notification. I know some of you were having issues with that. But anyway, so that will be going up later tonight after the pay-per-view. Follow along with me tonight on Twitter at Solomonster. We can commiserate together on there. I will be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. That'll be episode 587, as we are now officially, I guess, on the road to 600. We're not too far off from episode 600. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you for your support as always. It's been not an easy month. Got some stuff going on with my cat at home. And it's not good. So I've been dealing with that. And all of this is a good way to just sort of take my mind off things. And hopefully things get better. But I don't know what's going to happen. So I will see you back here next week. Enjoy the chamber tonight if you're off. Enjoy your President's Day holiday this week. And I'll see you back here for more Sound Off next week. And until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did-you-know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
So, Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.